who had died a long time ago, made their shit smell sweeter than other people's. Gardner said, "That's okay. It's from Chapter 2 of Tom Sawyer." When Bobby was a kid back in Utica, 7th grade, they had this thing called Junior Exhibition. It was a recitation competition. She didn't want to be in it, but her sister Anne decided she ought to be, that it would be good for her or something. And when Sister Anne decided something, brother, it was decided. Anne was a real tartar then, Bosey, and she's a real tartar now. At least I guess she is. I haven't seen her in a long time, and that's the way, oh-ho, uh-huh, I like it. But I think it's fair to say she's still the same. People like her very rarely change. "Don't call me Bosey," Andy said, hoping he sounded more dangerous than he felt. "I don't like it." When I had Bobby in freshman comp, she wrote once about how she froze trying to recite Tom Sawyer. I just about cracked up. Gardner got to his feet and started walking toward Andy, a development the ex-realtor viewed with active alarm. I saw her after class the next day and asked her if she still remembered how whitewashing the fence went. She did. I wasn't surprised. There are some things you never forget, like when your sister or your mother bulldozed you into some horror show like Junior X. You may forget the piece when you're standing up there in front of all those people. Otherwise, you could recite it on your deathbed. "Look," Andy said, "we ought to get back to work." I let her get about 4 sentences in, then I joined her. Her jaw dropped almost down to her knees. Then she started grinning, and we went through it together, word for word. It wasn't so strange. We were both shy kids, Bobby and I. Her sister was the dragon in front of her cave. My mother was the dragon in front of mine. People like that often get this very weird idea that the way to cure a shy kid is to put them into the sort of situation he dreads the most. Something like Junior X. Wasn't even much of a coincidence that we'd both gotten that whitewashing thing by heart. The only one more popular for recitation is the Telltale Heart. Gardner drew in breath and screamed, "Stop, fiends, dissemble no more. Tear up the floorboards. Hear, hear, 'tis the beating of his hideous heart." Andy had uttered a small shriek. He dropped his thermos, and half a cup of cold coffee stained the crotch of his pants. "Uh-oh, Bosey," Gardner said conversationally. "Never get that out of those polyester slacks." "Only difference between the two of us is that I didn't freeze," Gardner said. "In fact, I won a second prize ribbon. But it didn't cure my fear of talking in front of crowds. Only made it worse. Whenever I stand up in front of a group to read poetry, I look at all those hungry eyes. I think of whitewashing the fence. Also, I think about Bobby. Sometimes that's enough to get me through." Anyway, it made us friends. "I don't see what any of that has to do with getting this work done," Andy cried in a hectoring voice utterly unlike him. But his heart had been beating too fast. For a moment there, when Gardner had shrieked, he really had believed the man had gone insane. "You don't see what this has to do with whitewashing the fence?" Gardner asked and laughed. "Then you must be blind, Bosey." He pointed to the ship, leaning skyward at its perfect 45-degree angle, rising out of the wide trench. "We're digging it up instead of whitewashing it. But that doesn't change the principle a bit. I have fagged out Bobby Tremaine and John Enders, and if you're back tomorrow, I'll eat your hush puppies. Thing is, I never seem to get any prizes for it. You tell whoever comes out tomorrow I want a dead rat and a string to swing it by, Bosey. Or a bully taw, at the very least." Gardner had stopped halfway to the trench. He looked around at Andy. Andy's failure to read this big man with the sloping shoulders and the indistinct, oddly broken face had never made Bozeman more uncomfortable than it did then. "Better still, Bosey," Gardner had said in a voice so soft Andy could hardly hear it. "Get Bobby out here tomorrow. I'd like to find out if the new improved Bobby still remembers how to recite Whitewashing the Fence from Tom Sawyer." Then, without another word, he had gone to the sling and waited for Andy to lower him down. If that whole thing hadn't been left field, Andy didn't know what was. And, he added to himself as he turned the winch, that had only been Gardner's first beer of the day. He'll put away another 5 or 6 at lunch, and really get wild and crazy. Gardner now came swaying to the top of the trench, and Andy had an urge to let go of the windlass crank. Solve the problem. Except he couldn't. Gardner belonged to Bobby Anderson, and until Bobby either died or came out of the shed, things had to go on pretty much as they were. "Come on, Bosey. Some of those rocks fly a long way." He started toward the lean-to. Andy fell in beside him, hurrying to keep up. "I told you I don't like you calling me Bosey," he said. Gardner spared him a curiously flat glance.
"I know," he said.
They went around the lean-to. About 3 minutes later, another of those loud, crumping roars shuddered out of the trench. A spray of rocks rose into the sky and came down, rattling off the hull of the ship with dull clangs and clongs. "Well, let's," Bozeman began. Gardner grabbed his arm. His head was tilted, his face alert, his eyes dark and lively.
"Shh!"
Andy wrenched his arm away.
"What in the hell's wrong with you?"
"Don't you hear it?"
"I don't hear—"
Then he did. A hissing sound, like a giant tea kettle, was coming from the trench. It was growing. A mad excitement suddenly seized Andy. There was more than a little terror in it.
"It's them,"
he whispered, and turned toward guard. His eyes were the size of doorknobs. His lips, shiny with loose spittle, were trembling.
"They weren't dead. We woke them up. They're coming out."
"Jesus is coming, and is he pissed," Gardner remarked, unimpressed. The hissing grew louder. Now there was another crunching thud. This wasn't an explosion. It was the sound of something heavy collapsing. A moment later, something else collapsed. Andy. The strength ran out of his legs, and he fell to his knees.
"It's them! It's them! It's them!"
he slobbered. Gardner hooked a hand into the man's armpit, wincing a little at the hot, jungly dampness there, and pulled him to his feet.
"That's not the Tommyknockers," he said. "It's water."
"Huh?" Bozeman looked at him with dazed incomprehension.
"Water!" Gardner cried, giving Bozeman a brisk little shake. "We just brought in our swimming pool, Bozy."
"What?" The hiss suddenly exploded into a soft, steady roar. Water jetted out of the trench and into the sky in a widening sheet. This was no column of water. It was as if a giant child had just pressed his finger over a giant faucet to watch the water spray everywhere. At the bottom of the trench, water was driving up through a number of fissures in just that way.
"Water?"
Andy asked weakly. He couldn't get it right in his mind. Gardner didn't reply. Rainbows danced in the water. It ran down the sleek hull of the ship in rivulets, leaving beads behind. And as he watched, he saw those drops begin to skitter, the way water flicked into hot fat on a griddle will skitter and hop. Only this was not random. The drops were lining up in obedience to lines of force, which ran down the hull of the ship like lines of longitude on a globe. "I can see it," Gardner thought. "I can see the force radiating from the ship's skin in those drops. My God!" There was another crunch. Gardner seemed to feel the earth actually drop a bit under his feet. At the bottom of the trench, water pressure was finishing the work the blasting had begun, widening fissures and holes, pulling the friable rock apart. More water began to escape, and more easily. The sheets of spray fell back. A last, diffuse rainbow wavered in the air and disappeared. Gardner saw the ship shift as the rock weld which had prisoned it so long let go. It moved so slightly it might have been imagination. But it wasn't. In that brief movement, he could see how it would look coming out of the ground. He could see its shadow rippling slowly over the ground as it came up and out, could hear the unearthly wailing of its hull scraping over the bones of bedrock, could sense everyone in Haven looking this way as it rose into the sky, hot and glittering, a monstrous silver coin, slowly heeling over to the horizontal for the first time in millennia, floating soundlessly in the sky, floating free. He wanted that. God! Right or wrong, he wanted that so bad.
Gardner gave his head a brisk shake as if to clear it.
Come on, he said. Let's take a look.
Without waiting, Gardner walked across to the trench and looked in. He could hear rushing water, but it was hard to see. He attached one of the big kleegs they used for night work to the stirrup of the sling and lowered it about 10 feet. That was plenty. If he had lowered it another 10, it would have been underwater. It had been a lake they had broken into, all right, no joke. The trench was filling rapidly. After a moment, Andy joined him. His face was wretched.
All that work, he cried.
Did you bring your diving board, Bosey? Are we going to have free swim on Thursdays or fresh?
Shut up! Andy Bozeman screamed at him. Shut up! I hate you!
Wild hysteria washed over Gardner. He staggered away to a stump and sat down, wondering if the goddamn thing had stayed watertight all these years, wondering what the fair market price was for a flying saucer with water damage. He began to laugh. Even when Andy Bozeman came over and hit him upside the face and knocked him onto the ground, Jim Gardner couldn't stop laughing.
8. Thursday, August 4th. When it got to be 8:45 and still no one had shown up, Gardner began to wonder if maybe they were quitting. He toyed with the idea as he sat in Bobby's rocker on the porch, fingering the big, puffy bruise on the side of his face where Bozeman had clouted him. A bunch of them had been out in Archenborg's Cadillac again after midnight. Mostly the same bunch. Another midnight shed party. Gardner had hiked himself up on one elbow and watched them through the guest room window, wondering who brought the chips and dip to these soirees. They were just shadows grouped around the long front end of the Coupe de Ville. They stood there for a moment, then went to the shed. When they opened the door, that viciously brilliant light poured out in a flood that lit the entire yard and the guest room itself with a sick radium dial glow. They went inside. The glow faded down to a thick vertical bar, but didn't go out entirely. They had left the door ajar. The folks in this little jerkwater main town were now the brightest people on earth, but apparently not even they had been able to figure out how to padlock a door from the outside, and they hadn't thought to put one on the inside. Now, sitting on the porch and looking toward the village, Gardner thought, maybe when they get inside there, they get too exalted to think of mundane things like padlocks. He shaded his eyes with one hand. A truck was coming. A big old pulp truck that was vaguely familiar. There was a tarpaulin over something in the back. It flapped casually in the wind. Gardner knew it was going to turn in. Of course they hadn't given up. Woke up last night in the guest room bed, saw the folks going into the Tommyknocker's shed. Could have looked in, but I didn't quite dare. Don't want to know what goes on in there. He didn't think somehow that the judges of the Yale Younger Poets Competition would think much of it. But, Gardner thought, this is where Jim Gardner is now, as they say. Maybe later on they'll call it my Tommyknocker phase, or my shed period, or... The truck changed to a lower gear and came groaning into Bobby's dooryard. The engine died with a wheeze. The man in the strap-style T-shirt who got out was the man who had given Gard his ride to the Haven Town line on July 4th. He recognized the man at once. Coffee, he thought. You gave me coffee with a lot of sugar in it. Tasted good. He looked like an extra from the James Dickey novel about those city boys and their weekend canoe trip down the Cahoolawassee. Gardner didn't think the man was from Haven, though. Hadn't he said Albion? Stuff spreading, he thought. Well, why not? It's fallout, isn't it? And Albion's downwind.
Hello there, the truck driver said. Guess you don't remember me.
His tone added, don't fuck with me, Fred.
Guess I do, Guard said, and the name rose magically in his mind, even after all this, a single month that seemed more like 10 years with all these strange events.
Freeman Moss gave me a ride. I was come to check on Bobby. But I guess you know that.
Moss went to the back of the truck and began pulling slip knots and yanking rope.
Want to give me help with this?
Gardner started down the steps, then stopped, smiling a little. First Tremaine, then Enders, then Bozeman, with his somehow pitiful pale yellow polyester pants.
Sure, he said. Just tell me one thing.
Aya?
Moss left off pulling the ropes. He flipped back the tarpaulin, and Gardner saw about what he had expected, a weird conglomeration of equipment, tanks, hoses, 3 car batteries nailed to a board, a new and improved pump.
Well, if I can.
Gardner grinned without much humor. Did you bring me a dead rat and a string to swing it with?
9. Friday, August 5th. No air traffic had overflown Haven on a regular basis since the late 1960s, when Dow Air Force Base in Bangor had closed down. If someone had uncovered the ship in the earth back in those days, there might have been trouble. There had been Air Force fighter planes zooming overhead 4 and 5 times a day, rattling windows and sometimes breaking them with sonic booms. The pilots weren't supposed to boom over the continental United States, unless absolutely necessary. But the hotshots who flew the F-4s, most of them with adolescent acne still fading from their cheeks and foreheads, sometimes got a little exuberant. The jets made the Mustangs and Chargers these overgrown boys had been driving only a year before look mighty tame. When Dow closed, there were still a few Air National Guard flights, but the patterns were shifted north toward Loring in Limestone. After some dithering, the base was turned into a commercial airfield named Bangor International Airport. Some thought the name rather grand for an airport that serviced a few wheezy Northeast Airlines flights to Boston each day, and a handful of puddle-jumper pipers bound for Augusta and Portland. But the air traffic eventually grew, and by 1983, BIA had become a thriving air terminal. Besides serving 2 commercial airlines, it was also a refueling point for many international carriers, and so it finally earned its grand name. For a while, some commercial airliners did overfly Haven. This was in the early 70s. But pilots and navigators regularly reported radar problems in the area coded Quadrant G3, a square which took in most of Haven, all of Albion, and the China Lakes region. This cloudy interference known as popcorn, or echo haze, or even more colorfully as ghost turds, is also reported regularly over the Bermuda Triangle. Compasses went wacky. Sometimes there were funny cuckoo electrical glitches in the equipment. In 1973, a Delta jet southbound from BIA to Boston nearly collided with a TWA jet bound from London to Chicago. Drinks on both planes were spilled. The TWA stewardess was scalded by hot coffee. No one but the flight crews knew how close it had been. The co-pilot on the Delta plane ran a hot special delivery into his pants, laughed hysterically all the way to Boston, and quit flying forever 2 days later. In 1974, a Big Sky charter jet, loaded with happy gamblers bound for Las Vegas from Bangor and the Canadian Maritimes, lost power in one engine over Haven and had to return to Bangor. When the engine was restarted on the ground, it ran fine. There was another near miss in 1975. By 1979, all commercial air traffic had been routed out of the area. If you had asked an FAA controller about it, he would only have shrugged and called it a dragon. It was a word they used. There were such places here and there. No one knew why. It was easier to route planes away and forget it. By 1982,
private air traffic was also being routinely vectored away from G3 by controllers in Augusta, Waterville, and Bangor. So no pilot had seen the great shiny object winking up from the exact center of Map Square G3 on FAA map ECUS 2. Not until Peter Bailey saw it on the afternoon of August 5th. Bailey was a private pilot with 200 hours on his own in the air. He flew a Cessna Hawk XP, and he would have been the first to tell you that it had cost him a few banana skins. This was Peter Bailey's phrase for money. He found it hilarious. The Hawk cruised at 150 miles an hour and had good sky capability, 17,000 feet without breathing hard. The Cessna nav pack made it hard to get lost. The optional nav antenna had also cost a few banana skins. In other words, it was a good plane, one that could damn near fly itself, only it didn't have to with a good pilot like him driving. If Peter Bailey had a bitch, it was the goddamn insurance. It was highway robbery, and he had bored his golfing partners to tears with the outrage the insurance companies had foisted on him. He had friends who flew, he assured them grimly, plenty of them. A lot with less hours on their licenses than he had were forking over fewer banana skins to the insurance heathens than he was. Some were guys he wouldn't have flown with, he said, if they owned the last plane on Earth. And his wife was in Denver, dying of a brain hemorrhage. And the amount wasn't the greatest humiliation of all. The greatest humiliation of all was that he, Peter Bailey, he, a respected neurosurgeon who made well over 300,000 banana skins a year, had to accept pool coverage if he wanted to fly. Well, he told his captive audiences, who often wished fervently that they had only played the front nine, or better, it stayed in the bar and soaked up a few Bloody Marys. Pool coverage was assigned risk coverage, the sort teenagers and convicted drunks had to carry on their cars. Shit! If that wasn't goddamn discrimination, he didn't know what was. If he wasn't such a busy man, he'd slap the bastards with a class-action suit, and he'd win, too. Many of Bailey's golf companions were lawyers, and most knew it wouldn't wash. Risk coverage was made on the basis of actuarial tables, and the fact was Peter Bailey wasn't just a neurosurgeon, he was a doctor, and doctors have the worst record as private pilots of any professional group in the world. After escaping one of these foursomes, one of the players remarked as Bailey headed toward the clubhouse, still fuming, "I wouldn't even drive to Denver with the long-winded son of a bitch if my wife was dying of a brain hemorrhage." Peter Bailey was exactly the sort of flyer for whom the tables had been invented. There were undoubtedly doctors all over America who were exemplary pilots. Bailey wasn't one of them. Quick and decisive in the operating theater when a patient lay before him with a window of skull cut away to reveal the pinkish-gray brain tissue, as delicate as a dancer with scalpel and laser knife, he was a ham-fisted pilot who constantly violated assigned altitudes, FAA safety rules, and his own flight patterns. He was a bold pilot, but with only 200 hours on his license, he could by no stretch of the imagination be called an old pilot. His status as an assigned risk only confirmed the old saw. A pilot may be one or the other, but no pilot is both. He was flying alone that day from Teterboro, outside New York, to Bangor. At Bangor, he would rent a car and drive to Derry Home Hospital. He had been asked to consult in the case of young Hillman Brown. Because the case was interesting and the price right, and because he had heard good things about the golf course in Orono, he had agreed. The weather had been clear the whole way, the air smooth. Bailey had enjoyed the trip tremendously. As usual, his logbook was botched. He had missed one VOR beacon entirely and had decided another must be on the blink. He had hit the frequency dial with his elbow. He had wandered from his assigned altitude of 11,000 feet as high as 15,000 and as low as 6,000, and had once again avoided killing anyone, a blessing he was unfortunately too stupid to count. He also wandered well off his flight path, and so happened to overfly Haven, where a great blink of light suddenly flicked into his eye. It was as if someone had just flashed the lid of the world's biggest Crisco can up at him. What in the Sam Hill? He looked down and saw a tantalizing glimmer of that brightness. He might have dismissed it, might have gone on and survived to fight yet another day, or perhaps to collide with a fully loaded airliner. But he was early and intrigued. He banked the Hawk and went back. Now where? It flashed again, bright enough to dazzle a blue crescent of afterimage onto his eyes. Ripples of light ran across the top of the pilot's cabin. Jesus! There below him, in a clearing, in the gray-green woods, was a huge silver object. He could tell little about it before it was gone again under the port wing. At 6,000 feet for the second time that day, Bailey banked back again. His head had begun to ache. He noticed this and dismissed it as excitement. His first thought had been that it was a water tower, but no one would locate a water tower that big in the woods. He overflew the object again, this time at 4,000. He had the Hawk throttled back as far as he dared, which was a good deal further than a more experienced pilot would have dared do, but the Hawk was a good plane, and it forgave him. Artifact, he thought this time, almost sick with excitement. A great dish-shaped artifact in the earth, or some government thing. But if it was government, how come it wasn't covered with a camouflage net? And the ground around it had been excavated. From up here, the trench cut into the earth was perfectly clear. Bailey determined to overfly it again. Hell, he'd buzz it. And then his eye fell on his gauges, and his heart took an unsteady leap. His compass was winding itself around in big, stupid circles. The tank indicators were flashing red. The altimeter suddenly ran up to 22,000 feet, stopped briefly, and then dropped back to dead zero. The Hawk's husky 195-horsepower motor gave a terrifying hitch. The nose dipped. Bailey's heart did the same. His head throbbed. In front of his bulging eyes, needles were whirling. Lights flashed from green to red like pygmy traffic signals, and the altitude warning beeper, which was supposed to tell a bemused pilot, "Wake up, dummy, you are about to run into a large, immovable object called Mother Earth," began to sound, even though it wasn't supposed to go off until the plane passed through 500, and Bailey's own eyes told him the Hawk was still at 4,000 feet, perhaps a bit more. He looked at the digital thermometer, which recorded the outside air temperature. It blinked from 47 to 58, then to 5. It paused there for a moment, then showed 999. The red numerals held there, pulsing distractedly, and then the thermometer shorted out. "What in Christ's name is going on here?" Bailey screamed, and was stupidly amazed to see one of his front teeth fly out of his mouth, bounce off his airspeed indicator, and fall on the floor. The engine hitched again. "Fuck!" he whispered. He was now sick with fright. Blood from the socket where his tooth had been trickled down his chin. A drop splashed on his Lacoste shirt. The gleaming thing in the earth passed under his wings again. The Hawk's engine ran choppily and stalled. It began to lose altitude. Forgetting all his training, Bailey hauled up on the wheel as hard as he could, but the silent plane couldn't answer. Bailey's head pounded and thudded. The Cessna dropped to 4,000 feet, 3,500, 3,000. Bailey groped out with one hand like a blind man and thumbed the button marked Emergency Restart. High-test avgas boomed hollowly in the Hawk's carbs. The propeller jerked, then stopped again. Now the Cessna had slid down to 2,500 feet. It passed over the old dairy road, close enough for Bailey to be able to see the service board in front of the Methodist church. "Motherfuck," he whispered. "I'm gonna die." He pulled the choke all the way out and hit the restart button again. The engine coughed, ran for a while, then began to stutter. "No!" Bailey screamed. One eye ruptured and filled up with blood. The blood sheeted thinly down his left cheek. In his panicky, terrorized state, he didn't even notice. He slammed the choke in again. "No, don't you stall, you rat-shit plane!" The engine roared. The propeller blurred into invisibility with a wedge of reflected sunshine in it. Bailey hauled up on the wheel. The overburdened Hawk began to lug again. "Ratchet plane, ratchet plane, ratchet plane!" he screamed. His left eye was now full of blood, and he was on some level aware that the world seemed to have taken on a strange pinkish aspect. But if he'd had the time or inclination to think about this at all, he would have thought it no more than rage at this idiotic situation. He led off on the wheel. The hawk, allowed to climb at an angle which was almost sane, began to buckle down to its job again. Haven Village passed beneath it, and Bailey was aware of people looking up at him. He was low enough so someone could take his number if they thought of it.
"Go ahead," he thought grimly. "Go ahead. Take it. Because when I finish with Cessna Corporation, every goddamn stockholder they have is going to be standing in his underwear. I'm going to sue those negligent sons of bitches for every banana skin they've got."
The Hawk was rising smoothly now, its engine smooth and sweet. Bailey's head was trying to tear itself right off his shoulders, but an idea suddenly came to him. An idea of such stupefying simplicity and staggering ramifications that everything else was driven from his mind. He understood nothing less than the physiological basis of bicamerality in the human brain. This led to an instant understanding of race memory, not as a hazy Jungian concept, but as a function of recombinant DNA and biological imprinting. And with this came an understanding of what the increased miliary generating capacity of the corpus callosum during periods of increased ductless gland activity, which had puzzled students of the human brain for 30 years, actually meant. Peter Bailey suddenly understood that time travel, actual time travel, was in his grasp. At the same instant, a large portion of his own brain exploded. White light flashed in his head, white light exactly like the reflection that had winked at him from that object in the woods. If he had collapsed forward, pushing the wheel in, the people of Haven would have had another mess on their hands. But instead he fell backward, head lolling on his neck, blood running from his ears. He stared up at the ceiling of the pilot's compartment with an expression of stupendous, terminal surprise printed on his face. If the Cessna's autopilot had been engaged, it would almost certainly have flown serenely on until it ran out of fuel. Weather conditions were optimum, and such things have happened before. As it was, it flew along almost dead level at 5,500 feet for 5 minutes, anyway. The radio squawked at the dead neurosurgeon, telling him to get his ass up to his assigned altitude right now. Over Derry, a wind current threw the plane into a gentle bank. It flew in a long, looping arc toward Newport. The bank grew steeper, turned into a spiral. The spiral became a spin. A kid fishing off a bridge on Route 7 looked up and saw a plane falling out of the sky and whirling like a screw auger as it did. He stared open-mouthed as it crashed in Ezra Dockery's north field and exploded in a pillar of flame.
"Holy Jesus!" the kid yelled.
He dropped his fishing pole and ran for the Newport Mobile up the road to call the fire department. Shortly after he left, a bass snatched his worm and pulled his pole into the water. The kid never found the pole, but in the excitement of fighting the grass fire in Dockery's field and pulling the crispy pilot out of the remains of the Cessna, he barely noticed. 10. Saturday, August 6th. Newt and Dick were sitting in the Haven lunch. The newspaper was between them. The lead story was another outbreak of hostilities in the Mideast. The story that concerned them that morning was below the fold. "Neurosurgeon killed in light plane crash," the headline read. There was a photo of the plane. Nothing recognizable remained of the once beautiful Cessna Hawk, except its tail. Their breakfasts were pushed to one side, mostly untouched. Molly Fenderson, Beach's niece, was cooking now that Beach was dead. Molly was a hell of a nice girl, but her fried eggs looked like broiled assholes. Dick thought they tasted that way, too, although he'd never actually eaten an asshole, broiled or any other way.
"Might have," Newt said.
Dick looked at him, eyebrows raised.
"They put damn near anything in hot dogs. At least that's what I read once."
Dick's gut rolled over. He told Newt to shut his fucking gob. Newt paused, then said, "Must have been 20, 30 people seen that idiot come low across the village?
All from town? Dick asked.
Yes. Then we have no problem, do we?
No, I don't think so, Newt replied, sipping coffee.
At least, not unless it happens again.
Dick shook his head.
Shouldn't do.
Paper says he was off course.
Yeah.
So it's said.
You ready?
Sure.
They left without paying. Money had ceased to hold much interest to the residents of Haven. There were several large cardboard cartons of cash in Dick Allison's basement, carelessly tucked into the old coal hold. 20s, 10s, and 1s, mostly. Haven was a small town. When people needed cash for something, they came and got some. The house was unlocked. Besides telepathic typewriters and water heaters that ran on the power of collapsing molecules, Haven had discovered a nearly perfect form of collectivism. On the sidewalk in front of the lunch, they stared toward the town hall. The brick clock tower was flickering uneasily. One moment it was there, as solid as the Taj Mahal, if not so beautiful. The next, there was only blue sky above the jagged ruin of the tower's base. Then it would come back. Its long morning shadow fluttered like the shadow of a window shade blown by an intermittent wind. Newt found the fact that sometimes the shadow of the clock tower was there when the tower itself was not particularly disturbing.
"Christ, if I looked at that sucker too long, I'd go batshit," Dick said.
Newt asked if someone was taking care of the deterioration.
"Tommy Jacklin and Hester Brookline have had to go up to Derry," Dick said. "They're supposed to go to about 5 different service stations, plus both auto parts stores. I sent damn near $700 with them, told them to come back with as many as 20 car batteries if they could. But they're supposed to spread the buy around. There's people in some of the towns around here that think folks have gone battery crazy in Haven."
"Tommy Jacklin and Hester Brookline?" Newt asked dubiously.
"Christ, they're just kids. Has Tommy got a driver's license, Dick?"
"No," Dick said reluctantly. "But he's 15 and he's got a permit and he drives real safe. Besides, he's big. Looks older than he really is. They'll be okay."
"Christ, it's so fucking risky."
"It is, but..." They communed in thoughts that were more images than words. This was happening more and more in Haven, as the people in town learned this strange new thought language. For all of his misgivings, Newt understood the basic problem that had caused Dick to send a couple of underage kids to Derry in the Fannin's pickup truck. They needed batteries. Needed them. But it was getting harder and harder for the people who lived in Haven to leave Haven. If a codger like Dave Rutledge or an old coot like John Harley tried it, he would be dead, and probably rotting before he got to the Derry city line. It would take younger men like Newt and Dick a slightly longer time, but they would also go, and probably in agony, because of the physical changes that had begun in Bobby's shed. It didn't surprise either man that Hilly Brown was in a coma, and he had left when things were just starting to really roll. Tommy Jacklin was 15, Hester Brookline a well-developed 13. They at least had youth on their side, and could hope to leave and come back alive without the equivalent of NASA space suits to protect them from what was now an alien and inimical atmosphere. Such equipment would have been out of the question, even if they'd had it. They probably could have cobbled something together, but if a couple of folks showed up at the Napa auto parts store in Derry wearing moon suits, there might be a few questions. Or more than a few.
"I don't like it," Newt said at last.
"Hell, I don't either," Dick replied. "I'm not going to have a minute's peace until they get back, and I've got old Doc Warwick parked out by the Haven-Troy line to take care of them just as soon as they do."
"If they do."
"Aye, if. I think they will, but they'll be hurting."
"What kind of problems do you expect?"
Dick shook his head. He didn't know, and Doc Warwick refused to even guess, except to ask Dick in a cross mental voice what he, Dick, thought would happen to a salmon if it decided to ride a bike upstream to the spawning grounds instead of swimming.
"Well,"
Newt said, doubtfully.
"Well, nothing," Dick returned. We can't leave that thing. He nodded toward the oscillating clock tower. The way it is.
Newt returned.
We're almost down to the hatchway now. I think we could leave it.
Maybe. Maybe not.
But we need batteries for other things, and you know it. And we need to keep being careful. You know that, too.
Don't teach your Grammy to suck eggs, Dick.
Fuh.
Fuck that, asshole, was what Newt had been about to say, but he squashed it, although he found more to dislike about Dick Allison with every passing day. The truth was, Haven ran on batteries now, just like a kid's toy car from F.A.O. Schwartz, and they kept needing more and bigger ones. And mail order was not only too slow, it was the sort of thing that might send up a warning flag to someone somewhere. You could never tell. All in all, Newt Beringer was a troubled man. They had survived the plane crash. If something happened to Tommy and Hester, could they survive that? He didn't know. He only knew he wouldn't have much peace until the kids were back in Haven, where they belonged.
11. Sunday, August 7th. Gardner was at the ship, looking at it, trying to decide, again, if any good could come of this mess, and if not, if there was any way out. He had heard the light plane 2 days before, although he had been in the house and had come out a moment too late to see it on its third pass. Three passes was just about two too many. He had been pretty sure the pilot had spotted the ship and the excavation. The thought had afforded Gardner a strange, bitter relief. Then yesterday he had seen the story in the paper. He didn't have to be a college graduate to see the connection. Poor old Dr. Bailey had wandered off course, and that leftover from the space armada of Ming the Merciless had stripped his gears. Did that make him, Jim Gardner, an accessory to murder? It might. And wife shooter or not, Gar didn't care for the thought. Freeman Moss, the Dour woodsman from Albion, hadn't shown up this morning. Gard supposed the ship had blown his fuses as it had those of the others before him. Gard was alone for the first time since Bobby had disappeared. On the surface, that seemed to open things up. But when you look deeper, the same old conundrums remained. The story of the dead neurosurgeon and the crashed plane had been bad, but to Gard's mind, the story above the fold, the one Newt and Dick had ignored, was worse. The Mideast was getting ready to explode again, and if there was shooting this time, some of it might be nuclear. The Union of Concerned Scientists, those happy folks who kept the black clock, had advanced the hands to 2 minutes to nuclear midnight yesterday, the paper reported. Happy days were here again, all right. The ship could maybe pull the pin on all that. But was that what Freeman Moss, Kyle Archenborg, Bosey, and all the rest of them wanted? Sometimes Gard felt a sickening surety that cooling out the powder keg the planet was sitting on was the last thing the new and improved Haven was concerned with. And so? He didn't know. Sometimes being a telepathic zero was a pain in the ass. His eye moved to the pumping machinery squashed into the mud at the edge of the trench. Working at the ship had previously been a matter of dust and dirt and rocks and stumps that wouldn't come up until you were just about half crazy with frustration. Now it was wet work, very wet work indeed. The last couple of nights he had gone home with wet clay in his hair, between his toes and in the crack of his ass. Mud was bad, but clay was worse. Clay stuck. The pumping equipment was the strangest, ugliest conglomeration yet. But it worked. It also weighed tons. But the mostly silent Freeman Moss had transported it from Bobby's dooryard all by himself. It had taken him most of Thursday and about 500 batteries to do it, but he had done it, something which would have taken an ordinary construction crew a week or more to accomplish. Moss had used a gadget like a metal detector to guide each component to its final resting place. First, off the truck, then through the garden, then out along the well-worn path to the dig. The components floated serenely through the warm summer air, their shadows pooled beneath them. Moss carried the thing which had once been a metal detector in one hand, and something which looked like a walkie-talkie handset in the other. When he raised the curved stainless steel antenna on the end of the walkie-talkie gadget and moved the dish at the end of the detector, the motor or pump would rise. When he moved them to the left, the piece of equipment went left. Guard, watching this with the bemusement of a veteran drunk, and surely no one sees as many strange things as one of those, thought that Moss looked like a scrofulous animal trainer leading mechanical elephants through the woods to the site of some unimaginable circus. Gardner had seen the laborious moving of enough heavy equipment to know that this device could revolutionize construction techniques. Such things were outside his practical knowledge, but he guessed that a single gadget, such as the one Moss had used on Thursday, with such absent ease, could cut the cost of a project the size of the Aswan Dam by 25% or more. In at least one respect, however, it was like the illusion being maintained at the town hall. It required a lot of juice. "Here," Moss said, handing Guard a heavy pack sack. "Put this on." Guard winced, shouldering the straps. Moss saw it and smiled a little. "It'll get lighter as the day goes along. Don't you worry about that." He plugged the jack of a transistor earphone into the side of the radio controller and pushed the phone into his ear. "What's in the pack?" Gardner asked. "Batteries." "Let's go." Moss had switched the gadget on, seemed to listen, nodded, then pointed the curved antenna at the first motor. It rose in the air and hung there. Holding the controller in one hand and the customized metal detector in the other, Moss walked toward the motor. For every step he took, the motor retreated a similar distance. Guard brought up the rear. Moss walked the motor between the house and the shed, urging it around the tomcat, and then ahead of him through Bobby's garden. A wide path had been worn through this, but on both sides of it the plants continued to grow in rampant splendor. Some of the sunflowers were now 12 feet high. They reminded Gardner of the day of the Triffids. One night, about a week ago, he had awakened from a terrible nightmare. In it, the sunflowers in the garden had uprooted themselves and begun to walk, eldritch light shining from their centers and onto the ground like the beams of flashlights with green lenses. There were summer squashes in the garden as big as U-boat torpedoes, tomatoes the size of basketballs. Some of the corn was nearly as high as the sunflowers. Curious, Gardner had picked one of the ears. It was easily 2 feet long. A single ear, had it been good, would have fed 2 hungry men. But Guard had spat out the single mouthful of butter and sugar kernels he had bitten off, grimacing and wiping his mouth. The taste had been meaty and hideous. Bobby was growing a garden full of huge plants, but the vegetables were inedible, perhaps even poisonous. The motor had cruised serenely ahead of them along the path, cornstalks rustling and bending on either side as it pushed its way through. Gardner saw smears and swatches of grease and engine oil on some of the militantly green, sword-like leaves. On the far side of the garden, the motor began to sag. Moss had lowered the antenna, and the motor settled to the earth with a gentle thump. "What's up?" Gardner had asked. Moss only grunted and produced a dime. He stuck it in the base of his controller, twisted it, and pulled 6 AA Duracells out of the battery compartment. He tossed them indifferently on the ground. "Give me some more," he said. Gardner unshouldered the knapsack, undid the straps, opened the flap, and saw what looked at first glance like 1 billion AA's. It was as if someone had hit the grand jackpot at Atlantic City, and the machine had paid off in batteries instead of bucks. "Jesus!" "I ain't him," Moss said. "Give me 6 of those suckers." For once, Gardner didn't seem to have a wisecrack left in him. He handed 6 batteries over and watched Moss fit them into the compartment. Then Moss replaced the battery hatch, turned it on, refitted the earplug in his ear, and said, "Let's go." 40 yards into the woods, there was another battery change. 60 yards later, another. Floating the motor sucked less juice when it was going downhill, but by the time Moss had finally settled the big motor block on the edge of the trench, they had gone through 42 batteries. Back and forth, one by one, they brought the pieces of pumping machinery from Freeman Moss's truck to the edge of the trench. The knapsack on Gardner's back grew steadily lighter. On the fourth trip, Gard had asked Moss if he could try. A large industrial pump, whose raison d'etre before this odd little side trip had probably been pumping sewage from clogged septic tanks, was sitting on a tilted angle about 100 yards from the trench. Moss was once more changing batteries. Dead double A's lay all along the path now, reminding Gard with odd poignance of the kid at Arcadia Beach, the kid with the firecrackers, the kid whose mother had given up drinking, and everything else. The kid who had known about the Tommyknockers.
"Well, you can give her a try," Moss handed over the gadget. "I could use a smidge of help, and I don't mind saying so. Where's a man out lifting all that?"
He saw Gardner's look and said,
"Oh, hiya. I'm doing part of it myself. That's what the plug's for. You can try it, but I don't think you'll have much luck. You ain't like us."
I noticed. I'm the one that isn't going to have to buy a set of teeth from Sears and Roebuck when all this is over." Moss looked at him sourly and said nothing. Gard used his handkerchief to wipe off the brown coating of wax Moss had left on the earplug, then stuck it in his ear. He heard a distant sound like the one you heard when you held a conch shell to your ear. He pointed the antenna at the pump as he had seen Moss do, then cautiously flickered the antenna upward. The quality of the dim seashore rumble in his ear changed. The pump moved the tiniest bit. He was sure it wasn't just his imagination. But an instant later, two other things happened. He felt warm blood coursing down his face from his nose, and his head was filled with a blaring voice. "Carpet your den, or your whole home, for less!" screamed some radio announcer, who was suddenly sitting right in the middle of Gardner's head, and apparently yelling into an electric bullhorn, "And yes, we do have a new shipment of throw rugs. The last one sold out fast, so be sure—" "Ow, Jesus, shut up!" Gardner had cried. He dropped the handset and reached for his head. The earphone was dragged out of his ear, and the blaring announcer cut out. He had been left with a nosebleed and a head that was ringing like a bell. Freeman Moss, startled out of his taciturnity, stared at Gardner with wide eyes.
"What in Christ's name was that?"
he asked.
"That," Gardner said weakly, "was WZON, where it's only rock and roll, because that's the way you like it. You mind if I sit down for a minute, Moss? Think I just pissed myself. Your nose is bleeding, too."
"No shit, Sherlock," Gardner said.
"Think maybe you better let me use the lifter after this."
Gard had been more than happy to abide by that. It took them the rest of the day to get all the equipment out to the trench, and Moss was so tired when the last piece arrived that Gardner had to practically carry the man back to his truck.
"Feel like I just chopped 2 cord of wood and shit my brains out while I was doing it," the older man gasped.
After that, Gard hadn't really expected the man to come back. But Moss had shown up promptly at 7 the next day. He had been driving a beat-up split-grill Pontiac instead of his truck. He got out of the Pontiac, banging a dinner bucket against his leg. "Come on, let's get to it." Gardner respected Moss more than the other three helpers put together. In fact, he liked him. Moss glanced at him as they walked out to the ship with the morning dew of that Friday morning wetting down the cuffs of their pants.
"Caught that one," he grunted. "You're okay, too, I guess."
That was about all Mr. Freeman Moss had to say to him that day. They sank a nest of hoses into the trench and rigged more hoses, outflow hoses this time, to direct the water they pumped out downhill on a slope that ran a bit southeast of Bobby's place. These dumper hoses, as Moss called them, were big wide-bore rolls of canvas that Gard supposed had been scavenged from the VFD.
"Aye, got a few there, got a few other places,"
Moss said, and would offer no more on that subject.
Before starting the pumps, he had Gardner pound a number of U-shaped clamps over the dumper hoses.
Else they'll go whipping around, spraying water everywhere. If you've ever seen a fireman's hose out of control, you know someone can get hurt. And we ain't got enough men to stand around holding a bunch of pissing hoses all day.
Not that there'd be any volunteers standing in line, right?
Freeman Moss had looked at him silently, saying nothing for a moment. Then he grunted.
Pound those clamps in good. We'll still have to stop pretty often to pound 'em back in. They'll loosen up.
Can't you control the outflow so you don't have to bother with all this clamping shit? Gardner asked.
Moss rolled his eyes impatiently at his ignorance.
Sure, he said, but there's one fuck of a lot of water down in that hole, and I'd like to get it out before doomsday, if it's all the same to you.
Gardner held out his hands, half laughing.
Hey, I was just asking, he said. Peace.
The man had only grunted in his inimitable Freeman Moss style. By 9:30, water was pouring downhill and away from the ship at a great rate. It was cold and clear and as sweet as water can be, which is sweet indeed, as anyone with a good well could attest. By noon they had created a brand new stream. It was 6 feet wide, shallow, but brawling right along, carrying pine needles, loamy black topsoil, and small shrubs away. There was not much for the men to do but to sit around and make sure none of the plump, straining dumper hoses came free and started to fly around spraying water like bombed-out fire hydrants. Moss shut the pumps down regularly in sequence, so that they could pound in loose clamps or switch them to a new place if the ground was getting loose where they had been. By 3 o'clock the stream was rolling larger bushes downstream, and just before 5 o'clock, Gardner heard the rending rumble of a biggish tree going over. He got up and craned his neck, but it had happened too far down the new stream's course to see.
"Sounded like a pine," Moss said.
It was Gardner's turn to look at Moss and say nothing.
"Might have been a spruce," Moss said, and although the man's face remained perfectly straight, Gardner believed Moss might just have made a joke.
A very small one, but a joke, just the same.
"Is this water reaching the road, do you think?"
"Oh, aye, I should suspect."
"It'll wash it out, won't it?"
"Nope. Town crew's already putting in a new culvert. Large bore. Suppose they'll have to detour traffic a couple of days while they tear up the Tarvey. But they ain't so much traffic out here as they used to be, anyway."
"I noticed," Gardner said.
"Damn good thing, if you ask me. Summer people are always a pain in the ass."
"Look here, Gardner. I'm going to cut the outflow on these pumps way down, but they'll still pump 15, maybe 17 gallons a minute overnight. With 4 pumps working, that's 3,800 gallons an hour all night long. Not bad for running on automatic. Come on, let's go. Yon ship's lovely, but it makes my blood pressure jumpy. I'll drink one of your beers before I head home to the missus, if you'll let it be so."
Moss had shown up again yesterday, Saturday, in his old Pontiac, and had promptly run the pumps up to capacity, 35 gallons per minute each, 8,400 gallons an hour. This morning, no Freeman Moss. He had finally played out like the others, leaving Gardner to consider the same old options. First option, business as usual. Second option, run like hell. He had already come to the conclusion that if Bobby died, he would suffer a fatal accident soon afterward. It might take as long as 30 minutes for him to have it. If he decided to run, would they know in advance? Gardner didn't think so. He and the rest of Haven still played poker the old-fashioned way, with all the cards dealt face down. Oh, and by the way, gang, how far would he have to run to get out of the reach of them and their Buck Rogers gadgetry? Actually, Gar didn't think it would be that far. Derry, Bangor, even Augusta, all those might be too close. Portland? Maybe. Probably. Because of what he thought of as the cigarette analogy. When a kid started to smoke,
He was lucky if he could get through half a butt without puking his guts out or almost fainting. After 6 months' experience, he might be able to get through 5 or 10 butts a day. Give a kid 3 years, and you had yourself a 2.5-pack-a-day candidate for lung cancer. Then turn it over. Tell a kid who has just finished his first butt and who is wandering around green-faced and gagging that he has to quit smoking, and he'll probably fall down and kiss your ass. Catch him when he's doing 5 or 10 smokes a day, and you've got a kid who probably doesn't care much one way or another, although a kid habituated even at that level may find himself eating too many sweets and wishing for a smoke when he's bored or nervous. Ah, Gardner thought, but take your smoking vet. Tell him he's got to quit the coffin nails, and he clutches his chest like a man who's having a heart attack, only he's just protecting the smokes in the breast pocket of his shirt. Smoking, Gardner knew from his own mostly successful efforts to either quit the habit or at least damp it down to a less lethal vice, is a physical addiction. In the first week off cigarettes, smokers suffer from jitters, headaches, muscle spasms. Doctors may prescribe B12 to quiet the worst of these symptoms. They know, however, that there are no pills to combat the ex-smoker's feelings of loss and depression during the 6 months which begin the instant the smoker crushes out his last butt and starts his or her lonely voyage out of addiction. And Haven, Gardner thought now, running the pumps up to full power, is like a smoke-filled room. They were sick here at first. They were like a bunch of kids learning to smoke corn shucks out behind the barn. But now they like the air in the room. And why not? They're the ultimate chain smokers. It's in the air they breathe, and God knows what kinds of physiological changes are going on in their brains and bodies. Lung sections show formation of oat cells in the lung tissue of people who have been smoking for only 18 months. There's a high incidence of brain tumors in towns where there are high pollution milling operations, or, God save us, nuclear reactors. So what is this doing to them? He didn't know. He had seen no surface observable changes except for the loss of teeth and the increased shortness of temper. But he didn't think they'd chase him very far if he split. They might begin by lighting out after him with the fervor of a posse in a Republic Western, but he somehow thought they would lose interest very quickly, as soon as the withdrawal symptoms set in. He got all 4 pumps running at top speed, swelling the creek into a wide stream almost at once. Then he began the day's work of checking the U-clamps, which held the hoses still. If he got away, his choices were 2. Keep his mouth shut or blow the whistle. He knew that for a variety of reasons he would probably keep quiet, which meant simply dealing himself out, writing off the last month of back-breaking labor, writing off any chance to change the suicidal course of world politics at a stroke. Most of all, writing off his good friend and erstwhile lover, Bobby Anderson, who had been in absentia for the best part of 2 weeks now. Third option. Get rid of it. Blow it up. Destroy it. Make it no more than another vague rumor, like the supposed aliens in Hangar 18. In spite of his dull fury at the insanity of nuclear power and the energy-swilling technocratic pigs who had created it and underwritten it and refused to see its dangers even in the wake of Chernobyl, in spite of his depression at the AP wire photo of the scientists advancing the black clock to 2 minutes before midnight, he fully recognized the possibility that destroying the ship might be the best thing he could possibly do. The oxidation of whatever had been impregnated in the surface of its hull, deliberately, he had no doubt, had created a cornucopia of mind-blowing gadgets out here. God alone knew what wonderful things might be waiting inside. But there was the other stuff, wasn't there? The neurosurgeon in the crashed plane, that old man and the big state cop, maybe the lady constable, Mrs. McCausland. Maybe the 2 other state cops who had disappeared. Maybe even the brown kid. How much of this could be laid at the door of this thing he was staring at, which was jutting out of the ground like the breaching snout of the greatest white whale ever dreamed of? Some? All? None of the above? Gardner was sure of one thing. It wasn't the last. That the ship in the earth was a font of creation was undeniable. But it was also the wrecked craft of an unknowable species from somewhere far out in the blackness, creatures whose minds might be as different from those of human beings as human minds were from the minds of spiders. It was a marvelous, improbable artifact, shining in the hazy sunlight of this Sunday morning. But it was also a haunted house, where demons might still walk between the walls and in the hollow places. There were times when he would look at it and feel his throat fill up with strangeness, as at the sight of flat eyes staring up at him from the earth. But get rid of it. How? Blow it up. How? Even supposing he wanted to, how would he do it? The packet charges they had used to chop up the bedrock holding the ship fast were more powerful than dynamite, but they didn't even scratch the hull of the thing. Was he supposed to trot off to Limestone Air Force Base, steal an A-bomb, moving with the silky, unbelievable smoothness of Dirk Pitt in a Clive Cussler novel? And wouldn't it be funny, wouldn't it really be the last laugh, if he actually did manage to get a nuke and set it off, only to discover that all he'd really managed to do was to set the ship, still uncannily unharmed and unscratched, free at a stroke? Those were his options, the third of which was not an option at all. And apparently his hands had known more than his brain. For while he went on turning them over in his mind for the umpteenth time, he had gone calmly about the morning's work, driving the pumps up to full blast and making sure that the dumper hoses were solidly planted. Now he was back at the trench, checking the sucker hoses and the level of the water. He was happy to find he needed a powerful flashlight to see the water. It was falling rapidly. He guessed that blasting and excavation could begin again by Wednesday, Thursday at the latest, and once they got going again, the work would go fast. The rock of an aquifer was spongy and large-pored. They wouldn't need to waste time digging glory holes for explosives, because there would be enough natural spots for not just exploding radios, but satchel charges. The next phase would be like moving from a dense, gluey batter to a freshly risen dough. Guards stood bent over the cut in the earth for some time, shining the big light into the black depths. Then he clicked it off, meaning to inspect the clamps again. Here it was, only 8:30 in the morning, and already he wanted a drink. He turned around. Bobby was standing there. Gardner's mouth dropped open. He closed it with a snap after a moment, and started toward her, fully expecting this hallucination to grow transparent, then be gone. But Bobby stayed solid, and Guard saw that she had lost a great deal of hair. Her brow, a pale and shiny white, extended back nearly to the middle of her skull, leaving the world's biggest widow's peak in the center. Nor were these newly exposed sections of skull the only pale things about her. She looked like someone who had been through a terrible, debilitating illness. Her right arm was in a sling, and she's wearing makeup. Pancake makeup. I'm pretty sure that's what it is. She's laid it on heavy, the way a lady does when she wants to cover up a bruise. But it's her. Bobby. No dream. His eyes suddenly filled with tears. Bobby doubled, then trebled. It wasn't until then, that moment, that he realized just how scared he had been. And how lonely. Bobby? He asked hoarsely. Is it really you? Bobby smiled. That old, sweet smile he loved so well, the one that had saved him from his own idiot self so often. It was Bobby. It was Bobby, and he loved her. He went to her, put his arms around her, laid his tired face against her neck. He had done this before, too. "Hello, Guard," she said, and began to cry. He was crying, too. He kissed her. Kissed her. Kissed her. His hands were suddenly all over her. Her free one was on him. "No," he said, still kissing her. "No, you can't—" "Shh, I have to. It's my last chance, guard. Our last chance. Kissed. They kissed. Oh, they kissed, and now her shirt was unbuttoned. And this was not the body of a sex goddess. It was white and sickish, the muscles flabby, the breasts saggy, but he loved it, and he kissed her and kissed her, and their tears were all over each other's faces.
Guard, my dear, always my... Shh, oh, please, I love you.
Bobby, I love, love, kiss me.
Kiss, yes.
Pine needles under them, sweetness, her tears, his tears. They kissed, kissed, kissed. And as he entered her, Guard realized two things at once, how much he had missed her, and that not a single bird was singing. The woods were dead. Kissed.
12. Guard used his shirt, not very clean anyway, to wipe swatches of brown makeup from his naked body. It hadn't just been on her face. Had she come out here expecting to make love to him? Something it might be just as well not to think about. Now, anyway. Although they both should have been Thanksgiving dinner for the no-see-ums and moose flies, spouting sweat as they had been doing, he hadn't a single bite. He didn't think Bobby had either. It's not only an IQ booster, he thought, looking at the ship. It's got every insect repellent on the market beat hollow. He tossed his shirt aside and touched Bobby's face, running a finger down her cheek, picking up a little more of the makeup. Most of it, however, had either been sweated off or washed away by her tears.
"I hurt you," he said.
"You loved me," she answered.
"What?"
"You hear me, guard. I know you do."
"Are you angry?" he asked, aware that the barriers were going up again, aware that he was acting again, aware that it was over. All the things they'd had were finally over. These were sorry things to be aware of. "Is that why you won't talk to me?" he paused. "I wouldn't blame you. You've put up with a lot of shit from me over the years, woman."
"I was talking to you," she said.
And sorry as he was to be lying to her after loving her, he was glad to sense her doubt.
"With my mind."
"I didn't hear."
"You did before. You heard, and you answered. We talked, guard."
"We were closer to... that." He flagged an arm at the ship. She smiled wanly up at him and put her cheek against his shoulder. With most of the makeup scrubbed away, her flesh had an unsettling translucence. "Did I hurt you?"
"No."
"Yes. A little," she smiled. It was that old Bobby Anderson go-to-hell grin, but a final tear ran slowly down her cheek nonetheless.
"It was worth it.
We saved the best for last, guard."
He kissed her gently, but now her lips were different, the lips of the new and improved Roberta Anderson. "First, last, or in the middle, I didn't have any business making love to you, and you didn't have any business out here."
"I look tired, I know," Bobby said,
"and I'm wearing a lot of goop, as you already found out."
"You were right.
I let myself get overtired, and I had something like a complete physical breakdown."
"Bullshit," Gardner thought, but he covered his thought with white noise so Bobby couldn't read it. And he did this with barely a conscious thought. Such hiding was becoming second nature to him now.
"The treatment was radical. It's resulted in some superficial skin problems and some hair loss, but it'll all grow back."
"Oh," Gardner said, thinking, "you still can't lie for shit, Bobby. Well, I'm glad you're all right. But you maybe ought to take a couple of days off, put your feet up."
"No," Bobby said quietly. "This is the time for the final push, guard. We're almost there. We started this, you and me."
"No," Gardner said. "You started it, Bobby. You literally stumbled over it. Back when Peter was alive, remember?" Guard saw pain in Bobby's eyes at the mention of Peter. Then it was gone. She shrugged Guard's qualification off.
"You were here soon enough. You saved my life. I wouldn't be here without you. So let's do it together, guard.
I bet it's no more than another 25 feet down to that hatchway. Gardner had a strong hunch she was right, but he suddenly didn't feel like admitting it. There was a spike turning and turning in his heart, and the pain was worse than any hangover headache he'd ever had.
If you think so, I'll take your word for it.
What do you say, guard? One more mile, you and me. He sat thoughtfully looking at Bobby, noticing again how still, how almost malignant the woods seemed with no bird song in them. This is how it would be. This is how it will be, if one of their asshole power plants ever does melt down. The people will have smarts enough to get out. If they're warned in time, that is, and if the power plant in question and the NRC have balls enough to tell them. But you can't tell an owl or woodpecker to clear the area. You can't tell a scarlet tanager not to look at the fireball. So their eyes will melt, and they'll just go flapping around, blind as bats, running into trees and the sides of buildings until they starve to death or break their necks. Is this a spaceship, Bobby? Or is it a great big containment housing that's already leaking? It has, hasn't it? That's why these woods are so quiet. And that's why the polyester-clad neurologist bird fell out of the sky on Friday, isn't it?
What do you say, guard? One more mile?
So where's the good solution? Where's peace with honor? Do you run? Do you turn it over to the American Dallas police so they can use it on the Soviet Dallas police? What? What? Any new ideas, guard?
And suddenly he did have an idea. Or the glimmer of one. But a glimmer was better than nothing.
He hugged Bobby with a lying arm. Okay, one more mile. Bobby's grin started to widen, and then it became a look of curious surprise.
How much did he leave you, guard?
How much did who leave me?
The tooth fairy, Bobby said. You finally lost one, right there in the front.
Startled and a little afraid, guard raised his hand to his mouth.
Sure enough, there was a gap where one of his incisors had been yesterday.
It had started then. After a month working in the shadow of this thing, he had foolishly assumed immunity. But it wasn't so. It had started. He was on his way to becoming new and improved. On his way to becoming. He forced an answering smile.
I hadn't noticed, he said. Do you feel any different?
No, guard said, truthfully. Not yet, anyway. What do you say? You want to do some work?
I'll do what I can, Bobby said, with this arm.
You can check the hoses and tell me if any of them are starting to come loose. And talk to me. He looked at Bobby with an awkward smile. None of those other guys knew how to talk, man. I mean, they were sincere, but he shrugged. You know?
Bobby smiled back, and Gardner saw another brilliant, unalloyed flash of the old Bobby, the woman he had loved. He remembered the safe, dark harbor of her neck, and that screw in his heart turned again.
I think I do, she said, and I'll talk your ear off, if that's what you want.
I've been lonely, too.
They stood together, smiling at each other, and it was almost the same. But the woods were silent, with no bird song to fill them up.
The love's over, he thought. Now it's the same old poker game, except the tooth fairy came last night, and I guess the bastard will be back tonight.
Probably along with his cousin and his brother-in-law. And when they start seeing my cards, maybe exposing that glimmer of an idea like an ace in the hole, it'll be all over. In a way, it's funny. We always assumed the aliens would have to at least be alive to invade. Not even H.G. Wells expected an invasion of ghosts.
I want to have a look into the trench, Bobby said.
Okay. You'll like the way it's draining, I think.
Together they walked into the shadow cast by the ship.
13. Monday, August 8th. The heat was back. The temperature outside Newt Berenger's kitchen window was 79 at 7:15 that Monday morning. But Newt wasn't in the kitchen to read it. He was standing in the bathroom in his pajama bottoms, inexpertly plying his late wife's makeup to his face and cursing the way the sweat made the pancake clump up. He had always thought makeup a lot of harmless ladies' foofraw, but now, trying to use it according to its original purpose, not to accent the good but to conceal the bad, or at least the startling, he was discovering that putting on makeup was like giving someone a haircut. It was a fuck of a lot harder than it looked. He was trying to cover up the fact that over the last week or so the skin of his cheeks and forehead had begun to fade. He knew, of course, that it had something to do with the trips he and the others had made into Bobby's shed, trips he could not remember afterward, only that they had been frightening, but even more exhilarating, and that he had come out all three times feeling 10 feet tall and ready to have sex in the mud with a platoon of lady wrestlers. He knew enough to associate what was happening with the shed, but at first he had thought it was simply a matter of losing his usual summer tan. In the years before an icy winter afternoon and a skidding bread truck had taken her, his wife Eleanor liked to joke that all you needed to do was to put Newt under one ray of sun after the 1st of May and he turned as brown as an Indian. But last Friday afternoon, however, he was no longer able to fool himself about what was going on. He could see the veins, arteries, and capillaries in his cheeks, exactly as you could see them in that model he'd gotten his nephew Michael 2 Christmases ago, the amazing Visible Man, it was called. It was damned unsettling. It wasn't just being able to see into himself, either. When he pressed his fingers against his cheeks, the cheekbones felt definitely squashy. It was as if they were, well, dissolving. I can't go out like this, he thought. Jesus, no. But on Saturday, when he had looked in the mirror and realized after some thought and a lot of squinting that the gray shadow he was seeing through the side of his face was his own tongue, he had almost flown over to Dick Allison's. Dick answered the door looking so normal that for a few terrible moments Newt believed this was happening to him and him alone. Then Dick's firm, clear thought filled his head, making him weak with relief. "Christ, you can't go around looking like that, Newt. You'll scare people. Come in here. I'm going to call Hazel." The phone, of course, was really not necessary, but old habits died hard. In Dick's kitchen, under the fluorescent ring in the ceiling, Newt had seen clearly enough that Dick was wearing makeup. Hazel, Dick said, had showed him how to put it on. Yes, it happened to all the others except Adley, who had gone into the shed for the first time only 2 weeks ago. "Where does it all end, Dick?" Newt had asked uneasily. The mirror in Dick's hallway drew him like a magnet, and he stared at himself, seeing his tongue behind and through his pallid lips, seeing a tangled undergrowth of small, pulsing capillaries in his forehead. He pressed the tips of his fingers against the shelf of bone over his eyebrows and saw faint finger indentations when he took them away. They were like finger marks in hard wax, right down to the discernible loops and swirls of his fingertips, sunk into the livid skin. Looking at that had made him feel sick. "I don't know," Dick had answered. He was talking on the phone with Hazel at the same time. "But it doesn't really matter. It's going to happen to everyone eventually, like everything else. You know what I mean." He knew, all right. The first changes, Newt thought, looking into the mirror on this hot Monday morning, had in many ways been even worse, more shocking, because they had been so, well, intimate. But he had gone a ways toward getting used to it, which only went to show, he supposed, that a person could get used to anything, given world enough and time. Now he stood by the mirror, dimly hearing the DJ on the radio informing his listening audience that an influx of hot southern air coming into the area meant they could look forward to at least 3 days and maybe a week of muggy weather and temps in the upper 80s and low 90s. Newt cursed the coming humid weather. It would make his hemorrhoids itch and burn, it always did, and went on trying to cover his increasingly transparent cheeks, forehead, nose, and neck with Eleanor's Max Factor pancake. He finished cursing the weather and went fluidly on to the makeup with never a break in his monologue, having no idea that makeup grew old and cakey after a long period of time, and this particular lot had been in the back of a bathroom drawer since long before Eleanor's death in February 1984. But he supposed he would get used to putting the crap on, until such time as it was no longer necessary, anyhow. A person could get used to damn near anything. A tentacle, white at its tip, then shading to rose and finally to a dark blood red as it thickened toward its unseen base, fell through the fly of his pajama bottoms. Almost as if to prove his thesis, Newt Beringer only tucked it absently back in and went on trying to get his dead wife's makeup to spread evenly on his disappearing face. 14. Tuesday, August 9th. Old Doc Warwick slowly pulled the sheet up over Tommy Jacklin and let it drop. It billowed slightly, then settled. The shape of Tommy's nose was clearly defined. He'd been a handsome kid, but he'd had a big nose, just like his dad. His dad, Bobby Anderson thought sickly. Someone's going to have to tell his dad, and guess who's going to be elected. Such things shouldn't bother her anymore, she knew. Things like the Jacklin boy's death, things like knowing she would have to get rid of Guard when they reached the ship's hatchway. But they sometimes still did. She supposed that would burn away in time. A few more trips to the shed, that was all it would take. She brushed aimlessly at her shirt and sneezed. Except for the sound of the sneeze and the stertorous breathing of Hester Brookline in the other bed of the makeshift little clinic the doc had set up in his sitting cum examination room, there was only shocked silence for a moment. Kyle. He's really dead? No, I just like to cover him up that way sometimes for a joke, Warwick said crossly. Shit, man. I knew he was going at 4 o'clock. That's why I called you all here. After all, you're the town fathers now, ain't you? His eyes fixed for a moment on Hazel and Bobby. Excuse me, and 2 town mothers. Bobby smiled with no humor. Soon there was going to be only 1 sex in Haven. No mothers, no fathers. Just another Burmashave sign, you might say, on the great road of becoming. She looked from Kyle to Dick to Newt to Hazel, and saw that the others looked as shocked as she felt. Thank God she was not alone then. Tommy and Hester had gotten back all right, ahead of schedule, actually, because when Tommy started to feel really ill, only 3 hours after they had driven out of the Haven-Troy area, he had begun to push it, moving as fast as he could. The damn kid was really a hero, Bobby thought. I guess the best we can do for him is a plot in Homeland. But he was still a hero. She looked toward where Hester lay, pallid as a wax cameo, breathing dryly, eyes closed. They could have, maybe should have, come back when they felt the headaches coming on, when their gums began to bleed. But they hadn't even discussed it. And it wasn't only their gums. Hester, who had been menstruating lightly all during the becoming, unlike older women, teenage girls didn't ever seem to stop, or hadn't yet, anyway, made Tommy stop at the Troy General Store so she could buy heavier sanitary napkins. She had begun to flow copiously. By the time they had bought 3 car batteries and a good used truck battery in the Newport Dairy Town Line Auto Supply on Route 7, she had soaked 4 stay-free maxi pads. Their heads began to ache, Tommy's worse than Hester's. By the time they had gotten 6 Allstate batteries at the Sears store and well over 100 C, D, and double and triple A cells at the Dairy True Value Hardware, which had just gotten a new shipment in, they both knew they had to get back, quick. Tommy had begun to hallucinate. As he drove up Wentworth Street, he thought he saw a clown grinning up at him from an open sewer manhole. A clown with shiny silver dollars for eyes and a clenched white glove filled with balloons. 8 miles or so out of Derry, headed back toward Haven on Route 9, Tommy's rectum began to bleed. He pulled over and, face flaming with embarrassment, asked Hester if he could have some of her pads. He was able to explain why when she asked, but not to look at her while he did so. She gave him a handful, and he went into the bushes for a minute. He came back to the car, weaving like a drunk, 1 hand outstretched. "You gotta drive, Hester," he said. "I'm not seeing so hot." By the time they got back to the town line, the front seat of the car was splashed with gore, and Tommy was unconscious. By then, Hester herself was able to see only through a dark curtain. She knew it was 4 of a bright summer's afternoon, but Doc Warwick seemed to come to her out of a thundery purple twilight.
She knew he was opening the door, touching her hands, saying, "It's all right, my darling, you are back. You can let go of the wheel now. You are back in Haven." She was able to give a more or less coherent account of their afternoon as she lay in the protective circle of Hazel MacCready's arms, but she had joined Tommy in unconsciousness long before they got to the docks. Even though Doc was doing an unheard-of 65, his white hair flying in the wind. Adley McKean whispered, "What about the girl?" "Well, her blood pressure's dropping," Warwick said. "The bleeding's stopped. She is young and tough, good country stock. I knew her parents and her grandparents. She'll pull through." He looked around at them grimly, his watery old blue eyes not deceived by their makeup, which in this light made them look like half a dozen ghastly sun-tanned clowns. "But I don't think she'll ever regain her sight." There was a numb silence. Bobby broke it. "That's not so." Doc Warwick turned to look at her. "She'll see again," Bobby said. "When the becoming is finished, she'll see. We'll all see with one eye then." Warwick met her gaze for a moment, and then his own eyes dropped. "Yes," he said, "I guess. But it's a damn shame, anyway." Bobby agreed without heat. "Bad for her, worse for Tommy. No bed of roses for their folks. I have to go see them. I could use company." She looked at them, but their eyes dropped away from hers, a pair at a time, and their thoughts dulled into a smooth hum. "All right," Bobby said. "I'll manage, I guess." Adley McKean spoke up humbly. "I guess I'll come with you if you want, Bobby. Keep you company." Bobby gave him a tired yet somehow brilliant smile and squeezed his shoulder. "Thank you, Ad. For the second time, thank you." The two of them went out. The others watched them, and when they heard Bobby's truck start, they turned toward where Hester Brookline lay unconscious, hooked up to a sophisticated life support machine whose component parts had come from two radios, a turntable record changer, the auto-tuning device from Doc's new Sony TV, and, of course, lots of batteries. 15. Wednesday, August 10th. In spite of his tiredness, his confusion, his inability to stop playing Hamlet, and, worst of all, the persistent feeling that things in Haven were going wronger all the time, Jim Gardner had managed the booze pretty well since the day Bobby had come back and they had lain together on the fragrant pine needles. Part of the reason was pure self-interest. Too many bloody noses, too many headaches. Some of this was undoubtedly the influence of the ship, he thought. He hadn't forgotten he'd had one after Bobby had repeatedly urged him to touch her find, and he had seized the leading edge of the ship and felt that rapid, numbing vibration. But he was wise enough to know that his steady drinking was doing its part as well. There had been no blackouts per se, but there had been days when his nose had bled 3 and 4 times. He had always tended toward hypertension, and he had been told more than once that steady drinking could worsen what was a borderline condition. So he was doing fairly well, until he heard Bobby sneezing. That sound, so terribly familiar, called up a set of memories, and a sudden, terrible idea exploded in his mind like a bomb. He went into the kitchen, opened the hamper, and looked at a dress, the one she'd been wearing yesterday evening. Bobby did not see this inspection. She was asleep. She had sneezed in her sleep. Bobby had gone out the previous evening with no explanation. She had seemed nervous and upset to Gardner, and although both of them had worked hard all day, Bobby had eaten almost no supper. Then, near sundown, she had bathed, changed into the dress, and driven off into the hot, still, muggy evening. Gardner had heard her come back around midnight, had seen the brilliant flare of light as Bobby went into the shed. He thought she came back in around first light, but wasn't sure. All day today she had been morose, speaking only when spoken to, and only then in monosyllables. Gardner's clumsy efforts to cheer her up met with no success. Bobby skipped supper again tonight,
and just shook her head when Gardner suggested a few cribbage hands on the porch, just like in the old days. Bobby's eyes, looking out of that weird coating of flesh-colored makeup, had looked somber and wet. Even as Gardner noticed this, Bobby yanked a handful of Kleenex from the table behind her and sneezed into them two or three times, rapidly.
"Summer cold, I guess. I'm going to hit the rack, Gard. I'm sorry to be such a party pooper, but I'm whipped."
"Okay," Gard said. Something, some remembered familiarity, had been gnawing at him, and now he stood here with her dress in his hands, a light sleeveless summer cotton. In the old days it would have been washed this morning, hung on the line out back to dry, ironed after supper, and back in the closet again long before bed. But these weren't the old days. These were the new and improved days, and they washed clothes only when they absolutely had to. After all, there were more important things to do, weren't there? As if to confirm this idea, Bobby sneezed twice in her sleep.
"No," Gard whispered. "Please."
He dropped the dress back into the hamper, no longer wanting to touch it. He slammed the lid and then stood stiffly, waiting to see if the sound would wake Bobby.
She took the truck, went to do something she didn't want to do, something that upset her, something formal enough to need a dress. She came back late and went into the shed, didn't come into the house to change. Went in like she needed to go in, right away. Why?
But the answer, coupled with the sneezes and what he had found on her dress, seemed inevitable.
Comfort.
And when Bobby, who lived alone, needed comfort, who had always been there to give it? Gard? Don't make me laugh, folks. Gard only showed up to take comfort, not give it. He wanted to be drunk. He wanted that more than at any time since this crazy business had begun. Forget it. As he turned to leave the kitchen, where Bobby kept the alcoholic staples as well as the clothes hamper, something clitter-clicked to the boards. He bent over, picked it up, examined it, bounced it thoughtfully on his hand. It was a tooth, of course. Big number two. He put a finger into his mouth, felt the new socket, looked at the smear of blood on his finger pad. He went to the kitchen doorway and listened. Bobby was snoring gustily in her bedroom. Sounded as if her sinuses were closed up as tight as time locks. "A summer cold," she said. "Maybe so. Maybe that's what it is." But he remembered the way Peter would sometimes leap up into her lap when Bobby sat in her old rocker by the windows to read, or when she sat out on the porch. Bobby said Peter was most apt to take one of his boob-destroying leaps when the weather was unsettled, just as he was more apt to bring on one of her allergy attacks when the weather was hot and unsettled. "It's like he knows," she'd said once, and ruffled the beagle's ears. "Do you, Pete? Do you know? Do you like to make me sneeze? Misery loves company, is that it?" And Pete had seemed to laugh up at her in that way of his. Gardner remembered when Bobby's return had briefly wakened him last night. Bobby's return and that flare of green light. Hearing distant and meaningless heat-wave thunder. Now he remembered that sometimes Pete needed a little comfort, too. Especially when it thundered. Pete was deathly afraid of that sound, the sound of thunder.
"Dear Christ, has she got Peter out in that shed? And if she does, in God's name, why?"
There had been smears of some funny green goo on Bobby's dress, and hairs. Very familiar short brown and white hairs. Peter was in the shed, and had been all this time. Bobby had lied about Peter being dead. God alone knew how many other things she had lied about. But why this? Why? Gardner didn't know. He changed direction, went to the cupboard to the right and beneath the sink, bent, pulled out a fresh bottle of scotch, and broke the seal. He held the bottle up and said, "To man's best friend." He drank from the neck, gargled viciously, and swallowed. First swallow.
"Peter, what the fuck did you do to Peter, Bobby?"
He meant to get drunk. Very drunk. Fast. Book 3. The Tommyknockers.
I slept, and I dreamed the dream. This time there was no disguise anywhere. I was the malicious male-female dwarf figure, the principle of joy and destruction. And Saul was my counterpart, male-female, my brother and my sister, and we were dancing in some open place under enormous white buildings, which were filled with hideous, menacing black machinery which held destruction. But in the dream, he and I, or she and I, were friendly. We were not hostile. We were together in spiteful malice. There was a terrible yearning nostalgia in the dream, the longing for death. We came together and kissed, in love. It was terrible. And even in the dream I knew it, because I recognized in the dream those other dreams we all have, when the essence of love, of tenderness, is concentrated into a kiss or a caress. But now it was the caress of two half-human creatures, celebrating destruction. Doris Lessing, The Golden Notebook. Chapter 1. Sissy. 1.
I hope you enjoyed the flight,
the stewardess by the hatch told the 40-ish woman who left Delta's flight 2:30 with a trickle of other passengers, who had stuck it out all the way to Bangor, 2:30's terminating point. Bobby Anderson's sister, Anne, who was 40, but who thought 50 as well as looking it, Bobby would say, during those infrequent times she was in her cups, that Sister Anne had thought like a woman of 50 since she was 13 or so, halted and fixed the stew with a gaze that might have stopped a clock.
"Well, I'll tell you, babe," she said. "I'm hot. My pits stink because the plane was late leaving La Garbage and even later leaving Logan. The air was bumpy, and I hate to fly. The trainee they sent back to livestock class spilled someone's screwdriver all over me, and I've got orange juice drying to a fine crack glaze all over my arm. My panties are sticking in the crack of my ass, and this little town looks like a pimple on the cock of New England. Other questions?"
"No," the stew managed. Her eyes had gone glassy, and she felt as if she had suddenly gone about 3 quick rounds with Boom Boom Mancini on a day when Mancini was pissed at the world. This was an effect Anne Anderson often had on people.
"Good for you, dear."
Anne marched past the attendant and up the jetway, swinging a large, screamingly purple tote bag in one hand. The attendant never even had time to wish her a pleasant stay in the Bangor area. She decided it would have been a wasted effort anyway. The lady looked as if she had never had a pleasant stay anywhere. She walked straight, but she looked like a woman who did it in spite of pain somewhere, like the Little Mermaid who went on walking even though every step was like knives in her feet. Only, the flight attendant thought, if that babe has got a true love stashed anywhere, I hope to God he knows about the mating habits of the trapdoor spider. 2. The Avis clerk told Anne she had no cars to rent, that if Anne hadn't made a reservation in advance, she was out of luck, so sorry. It was summer in Maine, and rental cars were at a premium. This was a mistake on the part of the clerk. A bad one. Anne smiled grimly, mentally spat on her hands, and went to work. Situations like this were meat and drink to Sister Anne, who had nursed her father until he had died a miserable death on the 1st of August 8 days ago. She had refused to have him removed to an IC facility, preferring instead to wash him, medicate his bed sores, change his incontinence pants, and give him his pills in the middle of the night by herself. Of course, she had driven him to the final stroke, worrying him constantly about selling the house on Layton Street. He didn't want to. She was determined that he would. The final monster stroke, which occurred after 3 smaller ones at 2-year intervals, came 3 days after the house was put up for sale. But she would no more admit that she knew this than she would admit the fact that although she had attended St. Bart's in Utica ever since earliest childhood, and was one of the leading laywomen in that fine church, she believed the concept of God was a crock of shit. By the time Anne was 18, she had bent her mother to her will.
and now she had destroyed her father, and watched dirt shoveled over his coffin. No slip of an Avis clerk could stand against Sissy. It took her about 10 minutes to break the clerk down, but she brushed aside the offer of the compact car which Avis held in reserve for the occasional, very occasional, celebrity passing through Bangor, and pressed on, scenting the young clerk's increasing fear of her as clearly as a hungry carnivore scents blood. 20 minutes after the offer of the compact, Anne drove serenely away from Bangor International behind the wheel of a Cutlass Supreme, reserved for a businessman scheduled to deplane at 6:15 p.m. By that time the clerk would be off duty, and besides, she had been so unnerved by Anne's steady flailing that she wouldn't have cared if the Cutlass had been earmarked for the President of the United States. She went tremblingly into the inner office, shut the door, locked it, put a chair under the knob, and smoked a joint one of the mechanics had laid on her. Then she burst into tears. Anne Anderson had a similar effect on many people. 3. By the time the clerk had been eaten, it was going on 3 o'clock. Anne could have driven straight to Haven. The map she'd picked up at the Avis counter put the mileage at less than 50, but she wanted to be absolutely fresh for her confrontation with Roberta. There was a cop at the X-shaped intersection of Hammond and Union Streets. A streetlight was out, which she thought typical of this little running sore of a town. And she stopped halfway across to ask him for directions to the best hotel or motel in town. The cop intended to remonstrate with her for holding up traffic in order to ask for directions. And then, at the look in her eyes, the warm look of a fire in the brain which has been well banked and might flare at any time, decided it might be less trouble to give her the directions and get rid of her. This lady looked like a dog the cop had known when he was a kid, a dog who thought it fine fun to tear the seats from the pants of kids passing on the way to school. That kind of hassle on a day when both the temperature and his ulcer were too hot, he didn't need. He directed her to Cityscape Hotel out on Route 7, and was glad to see the ass end of her going away. 4. Cityscape Hotel was full. That was no trouble for Sister Anne. She got herself a double, then bullied the harried manager into giving her another because the air conditioner in the first rattled, and because the color on the TV was so bad she said that all the actors looked like they had just eaten shit and would soon die. She unpacked, masturbated to a grim and cheerless climax with a vibrator nearly the size of one of the mutant carrots in Bobby's garden. The only climaxes she had were of the grim and cheerless type. She'd never been with a man in bed and never intended to. Showered, napped, then went to dinner. She scanned the menu with a darkening frown, then bared her teeth in a spitless grin at the waiter who came to take her order. "Bring me a bunch of vegetables. Raw, leafy vegetables. Madame wants a bunch of raw, leafy vegetables. I don't give a shit what you call them. Just wash them first to get the bug piss off. And bring me a sombrero right now." "Yes, madame," the waiter said, licking his lips. People were looking at them. A few smiled, but those who got a look at Anne Anderson's eyes soon stopped. The waiter started away, and she called him back, her voice loud and even and undeniable. "A sombrero," she said, "has Kahlua and cream in it. Cream. If you bring me a sombrero with milk in it, chum, you're going to be shampooing with the motherfucker." The waiter's Adam's apple went up and down like a monkey on a stick. He tried to summon the sort of aristocratic, pitying smile which is a good waiter's chief weapon against vulgar customers. To do him full credit, he got a pretty good start on that smile. Then Anne's lips curved up in a grin that froze it dead. There was no good nature in that grin. There was something like murder in it. "I mean it, chum," Sister Anne said softly. The waiter believed her. 5. She was back in her room at 7:30. She undressed, put on a robe, and sat looking out the 4-story window. In spite of its name, Cityscape Hotel was actually far out on Bangor's outskirts. The view Anne looked out on was, except for the lights and the small parking lot, one of almost unalloyed darkness. That was exactly the sort of view she liked. There were amphetamine capsules in her purse. Anne took one of them out, opened it,
poured the white powder onto the mirror of her compact, made a line with one sensibly short nail, and snorted half of it. Her heart immediately began to jackrabbit in her narrow chest. A flush of color bloomed in her pallid face. She left the rest for the morning. She had begun to use yellow jackets this way shortly after her father's first stroke. Now she found she could not sleep without a snort of this stuff, which was the diametric opposite of a sedative. When she had been a little girl, a very little girl, her mother had once cried at Anne in utter exasperation, "You're so contrary, cheese at physic ya!" Anne supposed it had been true then, and that it was true now, not that her mother would ever dare say it now, of course. Anne glanced at the phone and then away. Just looking at it made her think of Bobby, of the way she had refused to come to Father's funeral. Not in words, but in a cowardly way that was typical of her, by simply refusing to respond to Anne's increasingly urgent efforts to communicate with her. She had called twice during the 24 hours following the old bastard's stroke, when it became obvious he was going to snuff it. The phone had not been answered either time. She called again after her father died, this time at 1:04 on the morning of August 2nd. Some drunk had answered the telephone. "I'd like Roberta Anderson, please," Anne said. She stood stiffly at the payphone in the lobby of Utica Soldiers Hospital. Her mother sat in a nearby plastic chair, surrounded by endless brothers and endless sisters, and their endless Irish potato faces, weeping and weeping and weeping. "Right now." "Bobby," the drunk voice at the other end said, "you want the old boss or the new and improved boss?" "Spare me the bullshit, Gardner. Her father has can't talk to Bobby now." The drunk, it was Gardner, all right, she recognized the voice now, broke in. Anne closed her eyes. There was only one piece of phone-related bad manner she hated worse than being broken in upon. "She's out in the shed with the Dallas police. They're all getting even newer and more improved. You tell her sister Anne, click." Dry rage turned the sides of her throat to heated flannel. She held the telephone handset away from her and looked at it the way a woman might look at a snake that has bitten her. Her fingernails were white going on purple. The piece of phone manner she hated most was being hung up on. 6. She had dialed back at once, but this time, after a long pause, the telephone began to make a weird sirening noise in her ear. She hung up and went over to her weeping mother and her harp relatives.
"Did you get her, sissy?"
her mother asked Anne.
"Yes."
"What did she say?"
Her eyes begged Anne for good news.
"Did she say she'd come home for his funeral?"
"I couldn't get a commitment one way or another," Anne said.
And suddenly all of her fury at Roberta, who had had the temerity to try to escape, suddenly burst out of her heart, but not in shrillness. Anne would never be still, or shrill. That shark-like grin surfaced on her face. The murmuring relatives grew silent and looked at Anne uneasily. The two old ladies gripped their rosaries. "She did say that she was glad the old bastard was dead. Then she laughed. Then she hung up." There was a moment of stunned silence. Then Paula Anderson clapped her hands to her ears and began to shriek. 7. Anne had no doubt, at least at first, that Bobby would be at the funeral. Anne meant for her to be there, and so she would be. Anne always got what she wanted. That made the world nice for her, and that was the way things should be. When Roberta did come, she would be confronted with the lie Anne had told, probably not by their mother, who would be too pathetically glad to see her to mention it, or probably even to remember it, but surely by one of the harp uncles. Bobby would deny it, so the harp uncle would probably let it go, unless the harp uncle happened to be very drunk, which was always a good possibility with Mama's brothers. But they would all remember Anne's statement, not Bobby's denial. That was good. Fine, in fact. But not enough. It was time, over time, that Roberta came home. Not just for the funeral, for good. She would see to it. Leave it to Sissy. 8. Sleep did not come easily to Anne that night in the cityscape. Part of it was being in a strange bed. Part of it was the dim gabble of TVs from other rooms and the sense of being surrounded by other people, just another bee trying to sleep in just another chamber of this hive, where the chambers were square instead of hexagonal. Part of it was knowing that tomorrow would be an extremely busy day. Most of it, however, was her continuing dull fury at being balked. It was the thing which she hated above all others. It reduced such annoyances to minor piffles. Bobby had balked her. So far she had balked her utterly and completely, necessitating this stupid trip, during what the weather forecasters were calling the worst heat wave to hit New England since 1974. An hour after her lie about Bobby to her mother and the Harp aunts and uncles, she had tried to phone again, this time from the undertaker's. Her mother had long since tottered home, where Anne supposed she would be sitting up with her cunt of a sister Betty, the two of them drinking that shitty claret they liked, wailing over the dead man while they got slopped. She got nothing but that sirening sound again. She called the operator and reported trouble on the line. "I want you to check it, locate the trouble, and see that it's corrected," Anne said. "There's been a death in the family, and I need to reach my sister as soon as possible."
"Yes, ma'am. If you'll give me the number, you're calling from—"
"I'm calling from the undertaker's," Anne said. "I'm going to pick out a coffin for my father and then go to bed. I'll call in the morning. Just make sure my call goes through then, honey." She hung up and turned to the undertaker. "Pine box," she said. "Cheapest one you've got."
"But, Miss Anderson, I'm sure you'll want to think about—"
"I don't want to think about anything," Anne barked.
She could feel the warning pulses which signaled the onset of one of her frequent migraine headaches.
"Just sell me the cheapest pine box you've got so I can get the fuck out of here. It smells dead."
"But," the undertaker was flabbergasted, "but won't you want to see—"
"I'll see it when he's wearing it," Anne said, drawing her checkbook out of her purse. "How much?"
9. The next morning, Bobby's telephone was working, but there was no answer. There continued to be no answer all day. Anne grew steadily more angry. Around 4 p.m., with the wake in the next room going full blast, she had called main directory assistance and told the operator she wanted the number of the Haven Police Department.
"Well, there's no police department exactly, but I have a listing for the Haven Constable with that—"
"Yeah, give it to me."
The directory assistance operator did. Anne called. The phone rang, rang, rang. The tone of the ring was exactly the same as the tone she got when she dialed the house where her spineless sister had been hiding out for the last 13 years or so. A person could almost believe they were ringing into the same receiver. She actually toyed with the idea for a moment before brushing it aside. But giving such a paranoid thought even a moment's house room was unlike her, and it made her angrier. The ring sounded alike because the same little dipshit backwoods phone company sold and serviced all the phone equipment in town, that was all.
"Did you get her?"
Paula asked timidly, coming to the door.
"No. She doesn't answer. The town constable doesn't answer. I think the whole fucking town went to Bermuda. Jesus!"
She blew a lock of hair off her sweaty forehead.
"Perhaps if you called one of her friends—"
"What friends? The loony she shacked up with?"
"Sissy, you don't know—"
"I know who answered the phone the one time I did get through," she returned grimly. "After living in this family, it's easier for me to tell when a man's drunk by his voice."
Her mother said nothing. She had been reduced to wet-eyed, trembling silence, one hand hovering at the collar of her black dress, and that was just how Anne liked her.
"No, he's there. And they both know I'm trying to get through, and why. And they're going to be sorry they fucked with me."
"Sissy, I do so wish you wouldn't use that length—"
"Shut up!"
Anne screamed at her. And, of course, her mother did. Anne picked up the telephone again. This time, when she dialed directory assistance, she asked for the number of the Haven mayor. They didn't have one of those, either. There was something called a town manager, whatever the fuck that was. Muffled little clicks, like rat's claws on glass, as the operator looked things up on her computer screen. Her mother had fled. From the other room came the theatrically overblown sobs and wails of Irish grief. Like a V-2 rocket, Anne thought, an Irish wake was powered by liquid fuel,
and in both cases the liquid was the same. Anne closed her eyes. Her head thumped. She ground her teeth together. It produced a bitter, metallic taste. She closed her eyes and imagined how good, how wonderful it would be to perform a little surgery on Bobby's face with her fingernails. "Are you still there, honey?" she asked without opening her eyes. "Or did you suddenly run off to the W.C.?"
"Yes, I have it. Give it to me."
The operator was gone. A robot recited a number in odd, herky-jerky cadences. Anne dialed it. She fully expected no answer, but the phone was picked up promptly.
"Selectmen's. Newt Barringer here."
"Well, it's good to know someone's there.
My name's Anne Anderson. I'm calling from Utica, New York. I tried to call your constable, but apparently he's gone fishing."
Barringer's voice was even.
"He's a she, Miss Anderson. She died unexpectedly last month. The office hasn't been filled. Probably won't be until next town meeting."
This stopped Anne for only an instant. She focused instead on something which interested her more.
"Miss Anderson? How did you know I was a miss, Barringer?"
There was no pause. Barringer said,
"Ain't you Bobby's sister? If you are, and if you were married, you wouldn't be Anderson, would you?"
"You know Bobby, then, do you?"
"Everyone in Haven knows Bobby, Miss Anderson. She's our resident celebrity. We're real proud of her."
It went through the meat of Anne's brain like a sliver of glass. A resident celebrity. Oh, dear bleeding Christ.
"Good job, Sherlock. I've been trying to reach her on whatever passes for phones up there in Moose Paw County to tell her her father died yesterday and he's going to be buried tomorrow."
She had expected some conventional sentiment from this faceless official. After all, he knew Bobby. But there was none.
"Been some trouble with the phones out her way," was all Barringer said.
Anne was again put momentarily off pace. Very momentarily. Anne was never put off pace for very long. The conversation was not going as she had expected. The man's responses were a little strange, too reserved even for a Yankee. She tried to picture him and couldn't. There was something very odd in his voice.
"Could you have her call me? Her mother is crying her eyes out in the other room. She's near collapse. And if Roberta doesn't get here in time for the funeral, I think she will collapse."
"Well, I can't make her call you, Miss Anderson, can I?"
Barringer returned with infuriating, drawly slowness.
"She's a grown woman. But I'll surely pass the message along."
"Maybe I'd better give you the number," Anne said through clenched teeth. "I mean, we're still here at the same old stand, but she calls so seldom these days, she might have forgotten."
"It's no need," Barringer interrupted. "If she don't remember or have it written down, there's always directory assistance, ain't there? I guess that's how you must have gotten this'n."
Anne hated the telephone because it allowed only a fraction of the full, relentless force of her personality to come through. She thought she had never hated it so much as she did at this moment.
"Listen," she cried. "I don't think you understand—"
"Think-a-do," Barringer said.
This was the second interruption, and the conversation was not 3 minutes old.
"I'll go out before I have my dinner and pass it on. Thanks for calling, Miss Anderson."
"Listen,"
before she could finish, he did the thing she hated the most. Anne hung up, thinking she could cheerfully stand by and watch as the jagoff to whom she had just been speaking was eaten alive by wild dogs. She had been grinding her teeth together madly. 10. Bobby didn't return her call that afternoon, nor that early evening, as the V-2 of the Wake entered the Boozosphere, nor that late evening as it went into orbit, nor in the 2 hours past midnight as the last of the Wakers stumbled blearily out to their cars, with which they would menace other drivers on their way home. Anne lay sleepless and ramrod straight in her bed most of the night, wired up on speed like a suitcase bomb, alternately grinding her teeth and digging her nails into her palms, planning revenge.
"You'll come back, Bobby. Oh, yes, you will. And when you do..."
When she still hadn't called the next day, Anne put the funeral off in spite of her mother's weak wailings that it wasn't fitting.
Finally, Anne whirled on her and snarled, "I'll say what's fitting and what isn't. What's fitting is that that little whore should be here, and she hasn't even bothered to call. Now leave me alone."
Her mother slunk away.
That night she tried first Bobby's number, then the selectman's office. At the first number the sirening sound continued. At the second she got a recorded message. She waited patiently until the beep, and then said, "It's Bobby's sis again, Mr. Barringer, cordially hoping that you'll be afflicted with syphilis that won't be diagnosed until your nose falls off and your balls turn black." She called directory assistance back and asked for three Haven numbers, the number of Newt Barringer, a Smith, any Smith, dear, in Haven they're all related, and a Brown. The number she received in response to this last request was, by virtue of alphabetical order, Bryant's. She got the same siren howl at each number.
"Shit!"
Anne yelled, and threw the phone at the wall. Upstairs in bed, her mother cringed and hoped Bobby would not come home, at least not until Anne was in a better mood. 11. She put the funeral and interment off yet another day. The relatives began to rumble, but Anne was more than equal to them, thank you. The funeral director took one look at her and decided the old Mick could rot in his pine box before he got involved. Anne, who spent the whole day on the phone, would have congratulated him on making a wise decision. Her fury was rapidly passing all previous bounds. Now all the phones into Haven seemed out of service. She could not delay the funeral another day longer, and she knew it. Bobby had won this battle. All right. So be it. But not the war. Oh, no. If she thought that, the bitch had several more things coming, and all of them would be painful. Anne bought her plane tickets angrily but confidently, one from upstate New York to Bangor, and two returns. 12. She would have flown to Bangor the following day. That was when the ticket was for, but her idiotic mother fell down the back stairs and broke her hip. Sean O'Casey had once said that when you lived with the Irish, you marched in the fool's parade, and oh, how right he had been. Her mother's screams brought Anne in from the backyard, where she had been lying on a chaise longue, soaking up some sun, then going over her strategy for keeping Bobby in Utica once she had gotten her here. Her mother was sprawled at the bottom of the narrow staircase, bent at a hideous angle, and Anne's first thought was that for a row of pins she would gladly have left the stupid old bitch there until the anesthetic effects of the claret began to wear off. The new widow smelled like a winery. In that angry, dismayed moment, Anne knew that all of her plans would have to be changed, and she thought that their mother might actually have done it on purpose. Gotten drunk to nerve herself up, and then not just fallen, but jumped downstairs. Why? To keep her from Bobby, of course. "But you won't," she had thought, going to the phone. "You won't. If I want a thing to be, if I mean a thing to be, that thing will be. I am going to Haven, and I am going to cut a wide swath there. I am going to bring Bobby back, and they're going to remember me for a long time, especially the hayseed dork who hung up on me." She picked up the phone and punched the medic's number. It had been pasted to the phone ever since her father's first stroke, with quick, angry stabs of her forefinger. She was grinding her teeth. 13. Thus it was the 9th of August before she could finally get away. In the caesura, there was no call from Bobby, and Anne didn't try to get her again, or the hick town manager, or Bobby's drunk fuck in Troy. He had apparently moved in so he could poke her full time. Okay, let them both fall into a lull. That would be very fine. Now she was here in Bangor's cityscape hotel, sleeping badly, and grinding her teeth. She had always ground her teeth. Sometimes it was so loud it awoke her mother in the night, and on a few occasions even her father, who slept like a brick. Her mother mentioned it to the family doctor when Anne was 3. That fellow, a venerable upstate New York GP, whom Doc Warwick would have felt right at home with, looked surprised. He considered a moment, then said,
I think you must be imagining that, Mrs. Anderson. If I am, it must be catching, Paula had said. My husband's heard it, too.
They looked toward Anne, who was building a shaky tower of blocks, one on top of the other. She worked with grim, unsmiling concentration. As she added a sixth block, the tower fell down, and as she started to rebuild it, they both heard the grim, skeletal sound of Anne grinding her baby teeth together.
"She also does that in her sleep?"
the doctor asked. Paula Anderson nodded.
"Well, it'll probably go away," the doctor said. "It's harmless."
But, of course, it didn't go away, and it wasn't harmless. It was bruxism, a malady which, along with heart attacks, strokes, and ulcers, often afflicts driven, self-assertive people. The first of Anne's baby teeth to fall out was noticeably eroded. Her parents commented on it, then forgot it. By then, Anne's personality had begun to assert itself in more gaudy and startling ways. By 6 and a half, she was already ruling the Anderson family in some strange way you could never quite put your finger on. And they had all gotten used to the thin, slightly gruesome whisper of Anne's teeth grinding together in the night. The family dentist had noticed the problem wasn't going away, but getting worse by the time Anne was 9, but it wasn't treated until she was 15, when it began to cause her actual pain. By then she had worn her teeth down to the live nerves. The dentist fitted her with a rubber mouth splint taken from a mold of her teeth, then an acrylic one. She wore these appliances, which are called night guards, to bed every night. At 18 she was fitted with all-metal crowns on most of her top and bottom teeth. The Andersons couldn't afford it, but Anne insisted. They had allowed the problem to slide, and she was not going to allow her skinflint father to turn around when she was 21 and say, "You're a grown-up now, Anne. It's your problem. If you want crowns, you pay the bill." She had wanted gold, but that really was beyond their means. For several years thereafter, Anne's infrequent smiles had a glittery, mechanized look that was extremely startling. People often actually recoiled from that grin. She took a grim enjoyment from these reactions, and when she had seen the villain Jaws in one of the later James Bond movies, she had laughed until she thought her sides would split. This unaccustomed burst of amusement had left her feeling dizzy and ill. But she had understood exactly why, when that huge man first bared his stainless steel teeth in a shark-like grin, people had recoiled from her, and she almost wished she hadn't finally had porcelain fused over the metal. Yet, she thought, it was perhaps better not to show oneself so clearly. It could be as unwise to wear your personality on your sleeve as it was to wear your heart there. Maybe you didn't have to look as though you could chew your way through a door made of oak planks to get what you wanted, as long as you knew you could. Bruxism aside, Anne also had had a lot of cavities, both as a child and as an adult. In spite of Utica's fluoridated water and her own strictly observed regimen of oral hygiene, she often flossed her teeth until her gums bled. This was also due, in large part, to her personality rather than her physiology. Drive and the urge to dominate afflict both the softest parts of the human body, stomach and vitals, and the hardest, the teeth. Anne had a chronic case of dry mouth. Her tongue was nearly white. Her teeth were dry little islands. Without a steady flow of saliva to wash away crumbs of food, cavities began quickly. By this night, when she lay sleeping uneasily in Bangor, Anne had better than 12 ounces of silver amalgam fillings in her mouth. On infrequent occasions, she had set off airport metal detectors. In the last 2 years, she had begun to lose teeth in spite of her frantic efforts to save them. 2 on the top right, 3 on the bottom left. In both cases, she had opted for the most expensive dental bridge work available. She had to travel to New York City to have the work done. The dental surgeon removed the rotting husks, flayed her gums to the dull white of the jawbone, and implanted tiny titanium screws. The gums were sewn back together and healed nicely. Some people reject metal implants in the bone, but Anne Anderson had no trouble at all accepting them, leaving 2 little titanium posts sticking out of the flesh. The bridge work was placed over the metal anchors after the flesh around them had healed.
She didn't have as much metal in her head as Guard did. Guard's plate always set off airport metal detectors, but she had a lot. So she slept without knowing that she was a member of an extremely exclusive club, those people who could enter Haven as it was now, with a bare chance of surviving. 14. She left for Haven in her rental car at 8 the following morning. She made one wrong turn, but still arrived at the Troy Haven town line by 9:30. She had awakened feeling as nervous and randy-dandy as a thoroughbred dancing her way into the starting gate. But somewhere in the last 15 or 20 miles before she reached the Haven town line, the land around her nearly empty, dreamingly ripe in the breathless summer heat hush, that fine feeling of anticipation and wire-thin, nervy readiness had bled away. Her head began to ache. At first it was just a minor throb, but it quickly escalated into the familiar pounding of one of her near migraines. She drove past the town line into Haven. By the time she got to Haven Village, she was hanging on to herself by force of will, and not much more. The headache came and went in sickish waves. Once she thought she had heard a burst of hideously distorted music coming out of her mouth, but that must have been imagination, something brought on by the headache. She was faintly aware of people on the streets in the little village, but not of the way they all turned to look at her. Her, then each other. She could hear machinery throbbing in the woods somewhere. The sound was distant and dreamlike. The cutlass began to weave back and forth on the deserted road. Images doubled, trebled, came reluctantly back together, then began doubling and trebling again. Blood trickled from the corners of her mouth, unnoticed. She held hard to one thought. It's on this road, Route 9, and her name will be on the mailbox. It's on this road, Route 9, and her name will be on the mailbox. It's on this road. The road was mercifully deserted. Haven slept in the morning sun. 90% of out-of-town traffic had been rerouted now, and this was a good thing for Anne, whose car pitched and yawed wildly, left-hand wheels now spuming dust from one shoulder, right-hand wheels spuming dust from the other a few moments later. She knocked down a turn sign without being aware of it. Young Ashley Ruval saw her coming, and pulled his bike a prudent distance off the road and stood astride it, in Justin Hurd's north pasture until she was gone. "A lady, there's a lady, and I can't hear her except her pain." 100 voices answered him, soothing him. "We know, Ashley, it's all right. Shh, shh." Ashley grinned, exposing his pink, baby-smooth gums. 15. Her stomach revolted. Somehow she was able to pull over and shut off the engine before her breakfast bolted up and out a moment after she managed to claw the driver's door open. For a moment she just hung there with her forearms propped on the open window of the half-open door, bent awkwardly outward, consciousness no more than a single spark, which she maintained by her determination that it should not go out. At last she was able to straighten up and pull the door closed. She thought in a dim and confused way that it must have been breakfast. Headaches she was used to, but she almost never threw up. Breakfast in the restaurant of that flea bag that was supposed to be Banger's best hotel. The bastards had poisoned her. I may be dying. Oh, God, yes, it really feels as if I might be dying. But if I'm not, I'm going to sue them from here to the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court. If I live, I'll make them wish their mothers never met their fathers. Perhaps it was the bracing quality of this thought which made Anne feel strong enough to get the car moving again. She crept along at 35, looking for a mailbox with Anderson written on it. A terrible idea came to her. Suppose Bobby had painted out her name on the mailbox. It wasn't so crazy when you really thought about it. She might well suspect Sissy would turn up, and the spineless little twat had always been afraid of her. She was in no shape to stop at every farm along the way, inquiring after Bobby. Not that she'd get much help from Bobby's hayseed neighbors, if the donkey she'd spoken to on the phone was any indication. But there it was. R. Anderson. and behind it a place she had seen only in photographs. Uncle Frank's place, the old Garrick farm. There was a blue truck parked in the driveway. The place was right, yes, but the light was wrong. She realized this clearly for the first time as she approached the driveway. Instead of feeling the triumph she had expected at this moment, the triumph of a predator that has finally succeeded in running its prey to earth, she felt confusion, uncertainty, and although she did not even really realize it for what it was because it was so unfamiliar, the first faint trickle of fear. The light was wrong. This realization brought others in quick succession. Her stiff neck, the circles of sweat darkening her dress under her arms, and her hand flew to her crotch. There was a faint dampness there, drying now, and she isolated a dim ammoniac smell in the car. It had been there for some time, but her conscious mind had just now tumbled to it. I pissed myself. And I've been in this fucking car almost long enough for it to dry. And the light, Anne. The light was wrong. It was sunset light. Oh, no, it's 9:30 in the... But it was sunset light. There was no denying it. She had felt better after vomiting, yes, and she suddenly understood why. The knowledge had been there all along, really, just waiting to be noticed, like the patches of sweat under the arms of her dress, or that faint smell of drying urine. She had felt better because the period between closing the door and actually starting the car again hadn't been seconds or minutes, but hours. She had spent all that brutally hot summer day in the oven of the car. She had lain in a death-like stupor, and if she had been using the Cutlass's air conditioning with all the windows rolled up when she stopped the car, she would have cooked like a Thanksgiving turkey. But her sinuses were nearly as bad as her teeth, and the canned air manufactured by automobile air conditioners irritated them. This physical problem, she realized suddenly, staring at the old farm with wide, bloodshot eyes, had probably saved her life. She had been running with all four windows open. Otherwise, this led to another thought. She had spent the day in a death-like stupor, parked by the side of the road, and no one had stopped to check on her. That no one had come along a main road like Route 9 in all those hours since 9:30 was something she just couldn't accept, not even out in the sticks. And when they did see you in trouble in Sticksville, they didn't just put the pedal to the metal and keep on going like New Yorkers stepping over a wino. What kind of town is this, anyway? That unaccustomed trickle again, like hot acid in her stomach. This time she recognized the feeling as fear, seized it, wrung its neck, and killed it. Its brother might show up later on, and if so, she would kill it too, and all the sibs that might follow. She drove into the yard. 16. Anne had met Jim Gardner only twice before, but she never forgot a face. Even so, she barely recognized the great poet, although she believed she could have smelled him at 40 yards if she had been downwind on even a moderately breezy day. He was sitting on the porch in a strappy T-shirt and a pair of blue jeans, an open bottle of scotch in one hand. He had a 3 or 4 day beard stubble, much of it gray. His eyes were bloodshot. Although Anne didn't know this and wouldn't have cared, Gardner had been in this state more or less for the last 2 days. All his noble resolves had gone by the boards since finding the dog hairs on Bobby's jacket. He watched the car pull into the dooryard, missing the mailbox by bare inches, with a drunk's bleary lack of surprise. He watched the woman get out, stagger, and hold on to the open door for a minute. "Oh, wow," Gardner thought. "It's a bird. It's a plane. It's Super Bitch. Faster than a speeding hate letter, able to leap cringing family members at a single bound." Anne shoved the car door closed. She stood there for a moment, throwing a long shadow, and Gardner felt an eerie sense of familiarity.
She looked like Ron Cummings when Ron had a skinful and was trying to decide if he could walk across the room. Anne made her way across the dooryard, trailing a steadying hand along the side of Bobby's truck. When she had passed the truck, she reached at once for the porch railing. She looked up, and in the slanting light of 7 o'clock, Gardner thought the woman looked both aged and ageless. She also looked evil, he thought, jaundiced and yellow-black, with a heavy freight of evil that was simultaneously wearing her out and eating her up. He raised the scotch, drank, gagged on the rank burn. Then he tipped the neck of it at her. "Hello, sissy. Welcome to Haven. Having said that much, I now urge you to leave as fast as you can." 17. She got up the first two steps okay, then stumbled and went to one knee. Gardner held out a hand. She ignored it. "Where's Bobby?" "You don't look so good," Gard said. "Haven has that effect on people these days." "I'm fine," she said, at last gaining the porch. She stood over him, panting. "Where is she?" Gardner inclined his head toward the house. The steady hiss of water came from one of the open windows. "Shower. We've been working in the woods all day, and it was extremely hot. Bobby believes in showering to remove dirt." Gardner raised the bottle again. "I believe in simply disinfecting. Shorter and pleasanter." "You smell like a dead pig," Anne remarked, and started past him toward the house. "While my own nose is undoubtedly not as keen as your own, dear heart, you have a delicate but noticeable odor of your own," Gard said. "What do the French call that particular perfume? Eau de pisse?" She turned on him, startled into a snarl. People in Utica, at least, didn't speak to her that way. Never. But, of course, they knew her. The great poet had undoubtedly judged her on the basis of his jizz receptacle, Haven's resident celebrity. And he was drunk. "Well," Gardner said, amused but also a trifle uneasy under her smoking gaze, "it was you who brought up the subject of aroma." "So I did," she said slowly. "Maybe we ought to start again," he said with drunken courtesy. "Start what again? You're the great poet. You're the drunk who shot his wife. I have nothing to say to you. I came for Bobby." "Good shot," the thing about the wife. She saw his face freeze, saw his hand tighten on the neck of the bottle. He stood there, as if he had at least temporarily forgotten where he was. She offered him a sweet smile. That smart-ass crack about eau de pisse had gotten through, but sick or not, she thought she was still ahead on points. Inside, the shower shut off, and perhaps it was only a hunch. Gardner had a clear sense of Bobby listening. "You always did like to operate without anesthetic. I guess I never got anything but exploratory surgery before this, huh?"
"Maybe."
"Why now, after all these years? Why did you have to pick now?"
"None of your business."
"Bobby's my business." They faced each other. She drilled him with her gaze. She waited for his eyes to drop. They didn't. It suddenly occurred to her that if she started into the house without saying more, he might attempt to restrain her. It wouldn't do him any good, but it might be simpler to answer his question. What difference did it make?
"I've come to take her home."
Silence again.
"There are no crickets."
"Let me give you a piece of advice, Sister Anne. Spare me. No candy from strangers, no advice from drunks. Do exactly what I told you when you got out of the car. Leave. Now. Just go. This is not a good place to be right now."
There was something in his eyes, something desperately honest, that brought on a recurrence of her earlier chill and that unaccustomed confusion. She had been left all day in her car at the side of the road as she lay in a swoon. What sort of people did that?
Then every bit of her Anne-ness rose up and crushed these little doubts.
If she wanted a thing to be, if she meant a thing to be, that thing would be. So it had been, was, and ever would be. Alleluia. Amen.
Okay, Chumley, she said. You gave me yours, I'll give you mine. I'm going inside that shack, and about 2 minutes later, a very large chunk of shit is going to hit the fan. I suggest you go for a walk if you don't want to get splattered. Sit on a rock somewhere and watch the sun go down and jerk off, or think up rhymes, or do whatever it is great poets do when they watch the sunset. But you want to keep out of what goes on in the house, no matter what. It's between Bobby and me. If you get in my way, I'll rip you up.
In Haven, you're more likely to be the rippee than the ripper.
Well, that's something I'll have to see for myself, even though I am not from Missouri, Ann said, and started for the door. Gardner tried once more. Ann?
Sissy?
Bobby's not the same. She... Take a walk, little man, Ann said, and went inside.
18. The windows were open, but for some reason the shades were drawn. Every now and then a puff of faint breeze would stir, sucking the shades into the openings a little way. When it happened, they looked like the sails of a becalmed ship doing their best and failing. Anne sniffed and wrinkled her nose. Blech! The place smelled like a monkey house. From the great poet she would have expected it, but her sister had been raised better. This place was a pigsty.
Hello, Sissy.
She turned. For a moment, Bobby was just a shadow, and Anne felt her heart go into her throat, because there was something odd about that shape, something all wrong. Then she saw the white blur of her sister's robe, heard the patter of water, and understood that Bobby had just come from the shower. She was all but naked. Good. But her pleasure was not as great as it should have been. Her unease remained, her feeling that there was something wrong about the shape in the doorway.
This is not a good place to be right now.
Daddy's dead, she said, straining her eyes to see better. For all her straining, Bobby remained only a dim figure in the door which communicated between the living room and, she assumed, bathroom.
I know. Newt Barringer called and told me. Something about her voice, something even more basically different in the vague suggestiveness of her shape. Then it came to her. The realization brought a nasty shock and a stronger fear. She didn't sound afraid. For the first time in her life, Bobby didn't sound afraid of her.
We buried him without you. Your mother died a little when you didn't come home, Bobby.
She waited for Bobby to defend herself. There was only silence.
For Christ's sake, come out where I can see you, you little coward.
Anne, Bobby's not the same.
She fell downstairs 4 days ago and broke her hip.
Did she?
Bobby asked, indifferently.
You're coming home with me, Bobby.
She meant to convey force, and was appalled by the weak shrillness of her voice.
It was your teeth that let you get in, Bobby said. Of course, I should have thought of that.
Bobby, get out here where I can see you.
Do you want me to?
Her voice had taken on a strange, teasing lilt.
I wonder if you do.
Stop fucking with me, Bobby!
Her voice rose unevenly.
Oh, listen, Bobby said. I never thought I'd hear anything like that from you, Anne. After all the years you've fucked with me. With all of us. But okay, if you insist, that's fine, just fine.
She didn't want to see. Suddenly Anne didn't want anything but to run, and keep running, until she was far away from this shadowy place and this town where they left you fainting all day at the side of the road. But it was too late. She saw the blurred movement of her younger sister's hand, and the lights went on at the same moment the robe dropped with a soft rustle. The shower had washed off the makeup. Bobby's entire head and neck were transparent and jelly-like. Her breasts had swelled bulbously outward and seemed to be merging into one single nippleless outcropping of flesh. Anne could see dim organs in Bobby's stomach that looked nothing at all like human organs. There was fluid circulating in there, but it looked green. Behind Bobby's forehead, she could see the quivering sack of mind. Bobby grinned toothlessly. "Welcome to Haven, Anne," she said. She felt herself stepping backward in a spongy dream. She was trying to scream, but there was no air. At Bobby's crotch, a grotesque thatch of tentacles like seagrass wavered from her vagina, the place where her vagina had been, anyway. Anne had no idea if it was still there or not, and didn't care. The sunken valley which had replaced her crotch was enough. That, and the way the tentacles seemed to be pointing toward her, reaching for her. Naked, Bobby began walking toward her. Anne tried to back away and stumbled over a footstool. "No," she whispered, trying to crawl away. "No, Bobby, no." "Good to have you here," Bobby said, still smiling. "I hadn't counted on you. Not at all. But I think we can find a job for you. Positions, as they say, are still open."
"Bobby!"
She managed this one final terrified whisper, and then felt the tentacles moving lightly on her body. She jerked, tried to move away, and they slithered around her wrists. Bobby's hips thrust out in a movement that was like an obscene parody of copulation.
Chapter 2 Gardner Takes a Walk 1 Gardner took Anne's advice and went for a walk. He went, in fact, all the way out to the ship in the woods. This was the first time he had been out here by himself, he realized, and it would soon be full dark. He felt vaguely afraid, as a child might, passing near a haunted house.
Are there ghosts in there? The ghosts of Tommyknocker's past? Or are the real Tommyknockers themselves still in there, maybe in suspended animation? Beings like freeze-dried coffee, waiting to be thawed out. And just what were they, anyhow?
He sat on the ground by the lean-to, looking at the ship. After a while, the moon rose and lit its surface an even more ghostly silver. It was strange, and yet very beautiful.
"What's going on around here?"
"I don't want to know."
"What it is ain't exactly clear.
I don't want to know."
"Hey, stop. What's that sound? Everybody look. What's going down?"
He tipped the bottle up and drank deep. He put it aside, rolled over, and rested his throbbing head on his arms. He fell asleep that way, in the woods, near the graceful circular jut of the ship. He slept there all night. In the morning, there were two teeth on the ground.
"That's what I get for sleeping so close to it," he thought dully. But there was at least one compensation. He had no headache at all, although he had put away nearly a fifth of scotch.
He had noticed before that, all its other attributes aside, the ship, or the change in the atmosphere the ship had generated, seemed, at very close range, to provide hangover protection. He didn't want to leave his teeth just lying there. Heeding an obscure urge, he kicked dirt over them. As he did it, he thought again, "Playing Hamlet is a luxury you can no longer afford, guard. If you don't commit to one course or the other very soon, in the next day or so, I think, you're not going to be able to do anything but march along with the rest of them." He looked at the ship, thought of the deep ravine which extended down its smooth, unmarked side, and thought again, "We'll be down to the hatchway soon, if there is a hatchway. What then?" Rather than trying to answer, he struck off for home.
2. The cutlass was gone. "Where were you last night?" Bobby asked Gardner.
"I slept in the woods."
"Did you get really drunk?" Bobby asked with surprising gentleness.
Her face was dark with makeup again, and Bobby had been wearing shirts which seemed oddly loose and baggy the last few days. This morning he thought he could see why. Her chest was thickening.
Her breasts had begun to look like a single unit instead of two separate things. It made Gardner think of guys who pumped iron.
"Not very. One or two nips and I passed out. No hangover this morning. And no bug bites."
He raised his arms, darkly tanned on top, white and strangely vulnerable beneath.
"Any other summer you'd wake up the next morning so bug-bit you couldn't open your eyes. But now they're gone. Along with the birds. And the beasts. In fact, Roberta, it seems to repel everything but fools like us."
"Have you changed your mind, Guard?"
"You keep asking me that. Have you noticed?"
Bobby didn't reply.
"Did you hear the news on the radio yesterday?"
He knew she hadn't. Bobby didn't see, hear, or think about anything now but the ship. Her head shake was no surprise.
"Troops massing in Libya. More fighting in Lebanon. American troop movements. The Russians getting louder and louder about SDI. We're all still sitting on the powder keg. That hasn't changed a bit since 1945 or so. Then you discover a deus ex machina in your backyard, and now you keep wanting to know if I've changed my mind about using it."
"Have you?"
"No," Gardner said, not sure if he was lying or not. But he was very glad Bobby couldn't read him.
"Oh, can't she? I think she can. Not much, but more than she could a month ago. More and more each day. Because you're becoming now, too. Changed your mind? That's a laugh. You can't fucking make up your mind."
Bobby dismissed it, or appeared to do so. She turned toward the pile of hand tools stacked on the corner of the porch. She had missed making up a spot just below her right ear, Gardner saw. It was the same spot many men miss when they are shaving. He realized with a sickish lack of surprise that he could see into Bobby. Her skin had changed, had become kind of semi-transparent jelly. Bobby had grown thicker, shorter over the last few days, and the changes were accelerating. "God," he thought, horrified and bitterly amused. "Is that what happens when you turn into a Tommyknocker? You start looking like someone who got caught in a great big messy atomic meltdown?" Bobby, who had been bending over the tools and gathering them up in her arms, turned quickly to look at Gardner, her face wary.
"What?"
"I said, let's get moving, you lazy juggins," Gardner sent clearly, and that wary, puzzled expression became a reluctant smile.
"Okay. Help me with these, then."
No, of course victims of high gamma radiation didn't turn transparent, like Claude Rains in The Invisible Man. They didn't start to lose inches as their bodies twisted and thickened. But yes, they were apt to lose teeth. Their hair was apt to fall out. In other words, there was a kind of physical becoming in both cases.
He thought again. Meet the new boss. Same as the old boss.
Bobby was looking narrowly at him again. I'm running out of maneuvering room, all right, and fast.
What did you say, guard?
I said, let's go, boss.
After a long moment, Bobby nodded.
Yeah, she said. Daylight's wasting.
3. They rode out to the dig on the Tomcat. It did not fly the way the little boy's bike had flown in E.T. Bobby's tractor would never soar cinematically in front of the moon, hundreds of feet above the rooftops. But it did cruise silently and handily 18 inches above the ground, large wheels spinning slowly like dying propellers. It smoothed the ride out a whole hell of a lot. Guard was driving, Bobby standing behind him on the yoke.
"Your sister left?" Guard said. There was no need to yell. The Tomcat's engine was a faint, distant purr.
"That's right," Bobby said. "She left."
"You still can't lie worth shit, Bobby. And I think, I really do, that I heard her scream just before I hit the patch going into the woods. I think I heard her scream."
How much would it take to make a high-stepping, pure-D, bald-cutting bitch like Sissy let out a howl? How bad would it have to be?
The answer to that one was easy. Very bad.
She was never the type to exit gracefully, Bobby said, or to let anyone be graceful if she could help it. She came to bring me home, you know. Watch that stump guard, it's a high one.
Gardner shoved the gear lever all the way up. The Tomcat rose another 3 inches, skimming over the top of the high stump. Once past, he relaxed his hand and the Tomcat sank back to its previous altitude, 18 inches above the ground.
Yes, she just came up here with her bit and her hackamore, Bobby said, sounding faintly amazed. There was a time when she might have taken me, too. As things are now, she never had a chance.
Gardner felt cold. There were a lot of ways a person could interpret a remark like that, weren't there? I'm still surprised it took you only one evening to convince her, Gardner said. I thought Patricia McCardle was bad, but your sister made old Patty look like Annette Funicello.
I just wiped off some of this makeup. When she saw what was underneath, she screamed, and left so fast you would have thought there were rockets in her heels. It was actually pretty funny.
It was plausible. It was so plausible that the temptation to believe it was almost insuperable.
Unless you ignore the simple fact that the lady under discussion couldn't have gone anywhere in a hurry without help. The lady could barely walk without help.
No, Gardner thought, she never left. The only question is whether you killed her or if she's out in the goddamn shed with Peter.
How long do the physical changes go on, Bobby?
Gardner asked.
Not much longer, Bobby said.
And Gardner thought again that Bobby had never been able to lie worth shit.
Here we are. Park it over by the lean-to.
4. The following evening they knocked off early. The heat was still holding, and neither of them felt capable of going on until the last light died. They returned to the house, pushed food around on their plates, even ate some of it. With the dishes washed, Gardner said he thought he would go for a walk.
Oh?
Bobby was looking at him with that wary expression which had become one of her main stocks in trade. I would have thought you'd gotten enough exercise today for anyone.
Sun's down now, Gard said easily. It's cooler. No bugs, and...
He looked clear-eyed at Bobby. If I go out on the porch, I'm going to take a bottle. If I take a bottle, I'm going to get drunk. If I go for a long walk and come back tired, maybe I can fall into bed sober for one night.
All of this was true enough. But there was another truth nested inside it, like one Chinese box inside another.
Gardner looked at Bobby and waited to see if she would go hunting for that inner box.
She didn't. All right, she said. But you know I don't care how much you drink, Gard. I'm your friend, not your wife.
No, you don't care how much I drink. You've made it very easy for me to drink all I want, because it neutralizes me.
He walked along Route 9 past Justin Hurd's place, and when he struck the Nister Road, he turned left and moved along at a good pace, his arms swinging easily. The last month's labor had toughened him more than he would have believed. Not so long ago, even a 2-mile walk such as this would have left him rubber-legged and winded. Still, it was eerie. No whippoorwills greeted the encroaching twilight. No dog barked at him. Most of the houses were dark. No TVs flickered inside the few lighted windows he passed.
Who needs Barney Miller reruns when you can become instead, Gardner thought.
By the time he reached the sign reading Road Ends 200 Yards, it was almost full dark, but the moon was rising, and the night was very bright. At the end of the road, he reached a heavy chain strung between two posts. A rusty, bullet-holed, no trespassing sign hung from it. Guard stepped over the chain, kept walking, and was soon standing in an abandoned gravel pit. The moonlight on its weedy sides was white as bone. The silence made Gardner's scalp prickle. What had brought him here? His own becoming, he supposed. Something he had picked out of Bobby's mind without even knowing he'd done it. It must have been that, because whatever had brought him out here had been a lot stronger than just a hunch. To the left was a thick triangular scar against the whiteness of the undisturbed gravel. This stuff had been moved around. Gardner walked over, shoes crunching. He dug into the fresher gravel, found nothing, moved, dug another hole, found nothing, moved, dug a third, found nothing. Oh, hey, wait a minute. His fingers skimmed across something much too smooth to be a stone. He leaned over, heart thudding, but could see nothing. He wished he had brought a flashlight, but that probably would have made Bobby even more suspicious. He dug wider, letting the dirt run and rattle down the inclined slope. He saw he had uncovered a car headlight. Gardner looked at it, filled with an eerie, skeletal amusement. This is what it's like to find something in the earth, he thought, to find some strange artifact. Only, I didn't have to stumble over it, did I? I knew where to look. He dug faster, climbing the slope and throwing dirt back between his legs like a mutt digging for a bone, ignoring his pounding head, ignoring his hands, which first scraped, then chafed, then began to bleed. He was able to clear a level place on the cutlass's hood, just above the right side headlights, where he could stand, and then the work went faster. Bobby and her buddies had done a casual burial job at best. Gardner pulled loose gravel down by the armload, then kicked it off the car. Pebbles shrieked and squealed on the metalwork. His mouth was dry. He was working his way up to the windshield, and he honestly didn't know which would be better, to see something or nothing. His fingers brushed slick smoothness again. Without allowing himself to stop and think, the silent creepiness of the place might have gotten to him then. He might have just turned and run. He dug a clear place on the windshield and peered in, cupping his hands to the glass to cut the glare from the moon. Nothing. Ann Anderson's rented cutlass was empty. I could have put her in the trunk. The fact is, you still don't know anything for sure. He thought he did, however. Logic told him that Ann's body wasn't in the trunk. Why would they bother? Anyone who found a brand new car buried out here in a deserted gravel pit was going to find it suspicious enough to investigate the trunk, or to call the police, who would do it. No one in Haven would give a rip one way or another. They have concerns more pressing than cars buried in gravel pits right now, and if someone from town did happen to find it, calling the police is the last thing they'd do. That would mean outsiders, and we don't want any outsiders in Haven this summer, do we? Perish the thought. So she wasn't in the trunk. Simple logic, QED. Maybe the people who did this didn't have your sterling powers of logic, Gard. That was a crock of shit, too. If he could see a thing from three angles, the Haven quiz kids could see it from 23. They didn't miss a trick. Gardner backed to the edge of the hood on his knees and jumped down. Now he was aware of his scraped, burning hands. He would have to take a couple of aspirin when he got back and try to conceal the damage from Bobby in the morning. Work gloves were going to be the order of the day. All day. Anne wasn't in the car. Where was Anne? In the shed, of course. In the shed. Gardner suddenly understood why he had come out here, not just to confirm a thought he had plucked from Bobby's head, if that was what he had done. His subconscious mind might simply have fixed on this as the handiest place to get rid of a big car quick. But because he had needed to make sure it was the shed. Needed to. Because he had a decision to make. And he knew now that not even seeing Bobby change into something which was not human was enough to force him into that decision. So much of him still wanted to dig the ship out, dig it out, and put it to use. So much, so very much. Before he could make the decision, he had to see what was in Bobby's shed. 5. Halfway back, he stopped in the cold, slippery moonlight, struck by a question. Why had they bothered to hide the car? Because the rental people would report it missing and more police would turn up in Haven? No. The Hertz or Avis people might not even know it was missing for days, and it would be longer still before the cops traced Anne's family connection here. At least a week, more like two. And Gardner thought by then Haven would be done worrying about outside interference one way or another for good. So who had the car been hidden from? From you, guard. They hid it from you. They still don't want you to know what they're capable of when it comes to protecting themselves. They hid it, and Bobby told you Anne went away. He went back with this dangerous secret turning in his mind like a jewel.
Chapter 3. The Hatch. 1. It happened 2 days later, as Haven lay sprawled and sunstruck under the August heat. Dog days had come, except, of course, there were no dogs left in Haven, unless maybe there was one in Bobby Anderson's shed. Guard and Bobby were at the bottom of a cut which was now 170 feet deep. The hull of the ship formed one side of this excavation, and the other side, behind the silvery mesh crisscrossing it, showed a cutaway view of thin soil, clay, schist, granite, and spongy aquifer. A geologist would have loved it. They were wearing jeans and sweatshirts. It was stiflingly hot on the surface, but down here it was chilly. Gardner felt like a bug crawling on the side of a water cooler. On his head he wore a hard hat with a flashlight attached to it by silver utility tape. Bobby had cautioned him to use the light as sparingly as possible. Batteries were in limited supply. Both of his ears were stuffed with cotton. He was using a pneumatic drill to shag up big chunks of rock. Bobby was at the other end of the cut, doing the same thing. Gardner had asked her that morning why they had to drill. "I like the radio explosives better, Bobby, old kid," he said. "Less pain and strain on the American brain. Know what I mean?" Bobby didn't smile. Bobby seemed to be losing her sense of humor, along with her hair. "We're too close now," Bobby said. "Using an explosive might damage something we don't want to damage."
"The hatch?"
"The hatch."
Gardner's shoulders were aching, and the plate in his head was aching as well. That was probably mental. Steel couldn't ache, but it always seemed to when he was down here. And he hoped Bobby would signal soon that it was time for them to knock off for lunch. He let the drill chatter and bite its way toward the ship again, not bothering too much about grazing that dull silver surface. You had to be careful not to let the tip of the drill walk onto it too hard, he had discovered. It was apt to rebound and tear off your foot if you weren't careful. The ship itself was as invulnerable to the rough kiss of the drill as it had been to the explosives he and his parade of helpers had used. There was at least no danger of damaging the goods. The drill touched the ship's surface, and suddenly its steady machine-gun thunder turned to a high-pitched squeal. He thought he saw smoke squirt from the pulsing blur of the drill's tip. There was a snap. Something flew past his head. All this happened in less than a second. He shut the drill off and saw the drill bit was almost entirely gone. All that remained was a jagged stub. Gardner turned around and saw the part that had gone winging past his face embedded in the rock of the cut. It had sheared a strand of the meshwork neatly in two. Delayed shock hit, making his knees want to come unlocked and spill him to the ground. "Miss me by a whore's hair. No more, no less. Mother!" He tried to pull it out of the rock, and thought at first it wasn't going to come. Then he began to wiggle it back and forth, like pulling a tooth out of a gum, he thought, and a hysterical titter escaped him. The chunk of drill bit came free. It was the size of a .45 slug, maybe a little bigger. Suddenly he was on the verge of passing out. He put an arm on the mesh-covered wall of the cut and rested his head on it. He closed his eyes and waited for the world to either go away or come back. He was dimly aware that Bobby's drill had also cut out. The world began to come back,
and Bobby was shaking him.
Guard? Guard, what's wrong?
There was real concern in her voice. Hearing it made Gardner feel absurdly like weeping. Of course, he was very tired.
I almost got shot in the head by a .45 caliber drill bit, Gardner said. On second thought, make that a .357 Magnum.
What are you talking about?
Gardner handed her the fragment he had worked out of the wall. Bobby looked at it and whistled.
Jesus.
I think he and I just missed connections. That's the second time I've almost gotten killed down in this shithole. The first was when your friend Enders almost forgot to send down the sling after I'd set one of those radio explosives.
He's no friend of mine, Bobby said absently. I think he's a dork.
Guard, what did you hit? What made it happen?
What do you mean? A rock? What else is there down here to hit?
Were you near the ship?
All of a sudden, Bobby looked excited.
No, more than that, nearly feverish.
Yes, but I've grazed the ship with the drill before. It just bounces, but...
But Bobby wasn't listening anymore. She was at the ship, down on her knees, digging into the rubble with her fingers.
It looked like it was steaming, Gardner thought.
It's here, Guard. Finally here.
He had joined her before he realized that she hadn't spoken the conclusion of her thoughts aloud. Gardner had heard her in his head.
2.
Something, all right, Gardner thought. Pulling aside the rock Gardner's drill had chunked up just before it exploded, Bobby had revealed, finally, a line in the ship's surface. One single line in all of that huge, featureless expanse. Looking at it, Gardner understood Bobby's excitement. He stretched out his hand to touch it.
Better not, she said sharply. Remember what happened before.
Leave me alone, Gardner said. He pushed Bobby's hand aside and touched that groove.
There was music in his head, but it was muffled and quickly faded. He thought he could feel his teeth vibrating rapidly in their sockets, and suspected he would lose more of them tonight.
Didn't matter. He wanted to touch it. He would touch it. This was the way in. This was the closest they had been to the Tommyknockers and their secrets. Their first real sign that this ridiculous thing wasn't just solid through and through. The thought had occurred to him. What a cosmic joke that would have been. Touching it was like touching starlight made solid.
It's the hatch, Bobby said. I knew it was here.
Gardner grinned at her. We did it, Bobby.
Yeah, we did it. Thank God you came back, Guard.
Bobby hugged him, and when Gardner felt the jelly-like movement of her breasts and torso, he felt sick revulsion rise in him. Starlight? Maybe the stars were touching him right now. It was a thought he was quick to conceal, and he thought that he did conceal it, that Bobby got none of it. That's one for me, he thought.
How big do you think it is?
I'm not sure. I think we might be able to clear it today.
It's best if we do. Time's gotten short, Guard.
How do you mean?
The air over Haven has changed. This did it.
Bobby rapped her knuckles on the hull of the ship. There was a dim, bell-like note.
I know.
It makes people sick to come in.
You saw the way Anne was.
Yes.
She was protected to some degree by her dental work. I know it sounds crazy, but it's true. Still, she left in a hell of a hurry.
Oh, did she?
If that was all, the air poisoning people who came into town, that would be bad enough.
But we can't leave any more, Guard.
Can't?
No.
I think you could. You might feel sickish for a few days, but you could leave.
It would kill me, and very quickly.
And something else. We've had a long siege of hot, still weather. If the weather changes, if the wind blows hard enough, it's going to blow our biosphere right out over the Atlantic Ocean. We'll be like a bunch of tropical fish just after someone pulled the plug on the tank and killed the rebreather. We'll die.
Guard shook his head. The weather changed the day you went to that woman's funeral, Bobby. I remember.
It was clear and breezy. That was what was so weird about you catching a sunstroke after all that hot and muggy. Things have changed. The becoming has speeded up.
Would they all die? Gardner wondered.
All of them?
Or just you and your special pals, Bobby? The ones that have to wear makeup now.
I hear doubt in your head, Gard, Bobby said. She sounded half exasperated, half amused.
What I doubt is that any of this can be happening at all, Gardner said. Fuck it. Come on. Dig, babe.
3. They took turns with a pick. One of them would use it for 15 minutes or so, and then both would clear away the rubble. By 3 that afternoon, Gard saw a circular groove that looked about 6 feet in diameter, like a manhole cover. And here, at last, was a symbol. He looked at it wonderingly, and at last he had to touch it. The blast of music in his head was louder this time, as if in weary protest or in weary warning, a warning to get away from this thing before its protection lapsed entirely. But he needed to touch it, confirm it. Running his fingers over this almost Chinese symbol, he thought, a creature who lived under the glow of a different sun conceived this mark. What does it mean? No trespassing? We came in peace? Or is it maybe a plague symbol, an alien version of abandon hope, all ye who enter in here? It was pressed into the metal of the ship like a bas-relief. Merely touching it brought on a species of superstitious dread he had never felt before. He would have laughed if, 6 weeks ago, someone had told him he might feel this way, like a caveman watching an eclipse of the sun, or a medieval peasant watching the arrival of what would eventually become known as Halley's Comet. A creature who lived under the glow of a different sun conceived this mark. I, James Eric Gardner, born in Portland, Maine, United States of America, Western Hemisphere of the world, am touching a symbol made and struck by God only knows what sort of being across a black distance of light years. My God! My God! I am touching a different mind. He had, of course, been touching different minds for some time now, but this was not the same. Not the same at all. Are we really going in? He was aware that his nose was bleeding again, but not even that could make him take his hand away from that symbol. He trailed the pads of his fingers restlessly back and forth across its smooth, unknowable surface. More accurately, are you going to try to go in there? Are you? Even though you know it may, probably will, kill you. You get a jolt every time you touch the thing. What's going to happen if you're foolish enough to go inside? It will probably set up a harmonic vibration in that damn steel plate of yours that will blow your head apart like a stick of dynamite in a rotten turnip. Awfully concerned about your welfare for a man who was on the verge of suicide not very long ago, aren't you, good buddy? He thought, and had to grin in spite of himself. He drew his fingers away from the shape of the symbol, flicking them absently to get rid of the tingle, like a man trying to shake off a good-sized booger. Go on and go for it. What the fuck? If you're going to step out anyway, having your brains vibrated to death inside of a flying saucer is a more exotic way to go than most. Gard laughed aloud. It was a strange sound at the bottom of that deep slit in the ground.
What's funny? Bobby asked quietly. What's funny, Gard?
Laughing harder, Gardner said, Everything. This is something else. I guess it's laugh or go crazy. You dig it? Bobby looked at him, obviously not digging it, and Gardner thought, Of course she doesn't. Bobby got stuck with the other option. She can't laugh because she went crazy. Gardner roared until tears rolled down his cheeks, and some of these tears were bloody, but he did not notice this. Bobby did, but Bobby didn't bother to tell him.
4.
It took them another 2 hours to completely clear the hatchway. When they were done, Bobby stuck out a dirty, makeup-streaked hand in Gardner's direction.
"What?"
Gardner asked, shaking it.
"That's it," Bobby said. "We're finished with the dig."
"We're done, Gard."
"Yeah?"
"Yeah. Tomorrow we go inside, Gard."
Gard looked at her without saying anything. His mouth felt dry.
"Yes," Bobby said, and nodded, as if Gard had questioned this.
"Tomorrow we go in."
Sometimes it seemed like I started this about 1 million years ago. Sometimes like it was just yesterday. I stumbled over it, and I saw it, and I ran my fingers along it and blew off the dirt. That was the start. One finger dragged through the dirt. This is the end.
That was a different Bobby at the beginning, Gardner said.
Yes, Bobby said meditatively. She looked up, and there was a sunken gleam of humor in her eyes. A different Guard, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess, you know, it'll probably kill me to go in there. But I'm going to give it a shot.
It won't kill you, Bobby said.
No?
No.
Now let's get out of here. I've got a lot to do. I'll be out in the shed tonight.
Gardner looked at Bobby sharply, but Bobby was looking upward as the motorized sling trundled down on its cables.
I've been building things out there, Bobby said. Her voice was dreamy. Me and a few others. Getting ready for tomorrow.
They'll be joining you tonight, Gardner said. It was not a question.
Yes. But first, I need to bring them out here to look at the hatch. They've been waiting for this day, too, Gard.
I'll bet they have, Gardner said. The sling arrived. Bobby turned to look at Gardner narrowly.
What's that supposed to mean, Gard?
Nothing. Nothing at all. Their eyes met. Gardner could feel her clearly now, working at his mind, trying to dig into it. And he had again that sense of his secret knowledge and secret doubts turning and turning like a dangerous jewel. He thought deliberately, "Get out of my head, Bobby. You're not welcome here." Bobby recoiled as if slapped. But there was also faint shame on her face, as if Gard had caught her peeking where she had no business peeking. There was still some humanness left in her then. That was comforting.
"Bring them out, by all means," Gard said. "But when it comes to opening it up, Bobby, it's just you and me. We dug the fucker up, and we go in the fucker first. You agree?"
"Yes," Bobby said. "We go in first, the two of us. No brass bands, no parades.
And no Dallas police."
Bobby smiled faintly.
"Not them, either."
She held out the sling. "You want to ride up first?"
"No, you go. It sounds like you got a schedule and a half still ahead of you."
"I do." Bobby swung astride the sling, pressed a button, and started up.
"Thanks again, Gard."
"Welcome," Gardner said, craning his neck to follow Bobby's upward progress.
"And you'll feel better about all of this?"
"When you become. When you finish your own becoming." Bobby rose up and up, and out of sight.
Chapter 4. The Shed.
1. It was August 14th. A quick calculation told Gardner that he had been with Bobby for 41 days, almost exactly a biblical period of confusion or unknown time, as in, he wandered in the desert for 40 days and 40 nights. It seemed longer. Seemed like his entire life. He and Bobby did no more than pick at the frozen pizza Gardner heated up for their supper.
"I think I'd like a beer," Bobby said, going to the fridge. "How about you? Want one, Gard?"
"I'll pass, thanks." Bobby raised her eyebrows but said nothing. She got the beer, walked out on the porch, and Gardner heard the seat of her old rocker creak comfortably as she sat down. After a while, he drew a cold glass of water from the tap,
went out and sat beside Bobby. They sat there for what seemed a long time, not speaking, just looking out into the hazy stillness of early evening.
"Been a long time, Bobby. You and me," he said. "Yes, a long time. And a strange ending."
"Is that what it is?" Gardner asked, turning in his chair to look at Bobby. "The end?" Bobby shrugged easily. Her eyes slid away from Gardner's.
"Well, you know.
End of a phase. How's that? Any better?"
"If it's le mot juste, then it's not just better, not even the best. Just the only mot that matters. Isn't that what I taught you?"
Bobby laughed.
"Yeah, it was. First damn class. Mad dogs, Englishmen, and English teachers."
"Yeah.
Yeah."
Bobby sipped her beer and looked out at the old dairy road again. Impatient for them to arrive, Gardner supposed. If the two of them had really said everything there was left to say after all these years, he almost wished he had never heeded the impulse to come back at all, no matter what the reasons or eventual outcome. Such a weak ending to a relationship which had, in its time, encompassed love, sex, friendship, a period of tense détente, concern, and even fear, seemed to make mock of the whole thing, the pain, the hurt, the effort.
"I always loved you, Gard," Bobby said softly and thoughtfully, not looking at him. "And no matter how this turns out, remember that I still do."
Now she did look at Gardner, her face a strange parody of a face under the thick makeup. Surely this was some hopeless eccentric who happened to resemble Bobby a little.
"And I hope you'll remember that I never asked to stumble over the goddamn thing. Free will was not a factor here, as some wise-ass or other has surely said."
"But you chose to dig it up," Gardner said. His voice was as soft as Bobby's, but he felt a new terror steal into his heart. Was that crack about free will a roundabout apology for his own impending murder? "Stop it, Gard. Stop jumping at shadows. Is the car buried out at the end of Mr. Road a shadow?" his mind returned at once. Bobby laughed softly.
"Man, the idea that whether or not to dig something like that up could ever be a function of free will.
You might be able to stick that to a kid in a high school debate, but we out on the poach, God. You don't really think a person chooses something like that, do you?
Do you think people can choose to put away any knowledge once they've seen the edge of it?"
"I've been picketing nuclear power plants on that assumption, yes," Gardner said slowly. Bobby waved it away.
"Societies may choose not to implement ideas. Actually, I doubt even that, but for the sake of argument, we'll say it so. But ordinary people?" "No, Gard, I'm sorry. When ordinary people see something sticking out of the ground, they got to dig on it. They got to dig on it, because it might be treasure."
"And you didn't have the slightest inkling that there would be..." Fallout was the word that came to mind. He didn't think it was a word Bobby would like.
"Consequences?"
Bobby smiled openly.
"Not a hint in the world."
"But Peter didn't like it."
"No, Peter didn't like it. But it didn't kill him, Gard."
"I'm quite sure it didn't."
"Peter died of natural causes. He was old. That thing in the woods is a ship from another world. Not Pandora's box. Not a divine apple tree. I heard no voice from heaven singing, 'Of this ship shalt thou not eat, lest ye die.'"
Gard smiled a little. "But it is a ship of knowledge, isn't it?"
"Yes, I suppose."
Bobby was looking toward the road again, obviously not wanting to pursue the topic further. "When do you expect them?" Gardner asked. Instead of answering, Bobby nodded at the road. Kyle Archenborg's caddy was coming, followed by Adley McKean's old Ford.
Guess I'll go inside and catch some winks, Gardner said, getting up.
If you want to go out to the ship with us, you're welcome to.
With you, maybe. With them? He cocked a thumb toward the approaching cars. They think I'm crazy. Also, they hate my guts because they can't read my mind.
If I say you go, you go.
Well, I think I'll pass, Gardner said, getting up and stretching. I don't like them either. They make me nervous.
I'm sorry.
Don't be. Just tomorrow. The two of us, Bobby. Right?
Right.
Give them my best, and remind them I helped, steel plate in my head or not.
I will. Of course I will.
But Bobby's eyes slid away again, and Gardner didn't like that. He didn't like it at all. 2. He thought they might go in the shed first, but they didn't. They stood around outside for a while talking, Bobby, Frank, Newt, Dick Allison, Hazel, the others, and then moved off toward the woods in a tight group. The light was shading down toward purple now, and most of them were carrying flashlights. Watching, Gard felt that his last real moment with Bobby had come and gone. There was nothing now but to go into the shed and see what was in there. Make up his mind once and for all. Saw an eyeball peeping through a smoky cloud behind the green door. He got up and went through the house to the kitchen in time to see them heading into Bobby's rampant garden. He counted noses quickly, making sure that they were all there, then headed for the cellar. Bobby kept a spare key ring down there. He opened the cellar door and paused one final time.
Do you really want to do this?
No. No, he did not. But he meant to do it. And he discovered that, more than fear, he felt a great sense of loneliness. There was literally no one else he could turn to for help. He had been in the desert with Bobby Anderson 40 days and 40 nights, and now he was in the desert on his own. God help him. To hell with it, he thought. Like the old World War I platoon sergeant was supposed to have said, "Come on, you guys, you want to live forever?" Gardner went downstairs to get Bobby's key ring. 3. It was there, hanging on its nail with every key neatly labeled. The only catch was the shed key was gone. It had been here. He was quite sure of that. When had he last seen it here? Gard tried to remember and couldn't. Bobby taking precautions? Maybe. He stood in the new and improved workshop, sweat on his forehead, and sweat on his balls. No key. That was great. So what was he supposed to do? Grab Bobby's axe and make like Jack Nicholson in The Shining? He could see it. Smash, crash, bash. Here's Gardner. Except that might be a bit hard to cover up before the pilgrims came back from the viewing of the sacred hatch. He stood in Bobby's workshop, feeling time slip away, feeling old and unimproved. How long would they be out there anyway? No way of telling, was there? No way at all. Okay, where do people put keys? Always assuming she really was just taking precautions and not just hiding it from you. A thought struck him so hard he actually slapped his forehead. Bobby hadn't taken the key, nor had anyone been trying to hide it. The key had disappeared when Bobby had supposedly been in the Dairy Home Hospital recovering from sunstroke. He was almost positive of that, and what memory would not or could not supply, logic did. Bobby hadn't been in Dairy Home, she had been in the shed. Had one of the others taken the spare key to tend her when Bobby needed tending? Did they all have copies? Why bother? No one in Haven was into stealing these days. They were into becoming. The only reason the shed was kept locked was to keep him out. So they could just... Gardner remembered watching them arrive on one of the occasions after the something had happened to Bobby. The something that had been a lot more serious than heat prostration. He closed his eyes and saw the caddy. Kyle won. They get out and... And Archambault splits off from the rest for a moment or two. You're up on one elbow, looking out the window at them.
And if you think of it at all, you think he must have stepped around there to tap a kidney. But he didn't. He went around to get the key. Sure, that's what he did, went around to get the key. It wasn't much, but it was enough to get him moving. He ran back up the cellar stairs, headed for the door, then doubled back. In the bathroom, there was an ancient pair of Foster Grant sunglasses on top of the medicine cabinet. They had come to rest up there with a finality that trivial objects managed to obtain only in a single man or woman's quarters, like the makeup which had belonged to Newt Beringer's wife. Gardner took the sunglasses down, blew a thick coating of dust from the lenses, wiped them carefully, then folded the bows and put them in his breast pocket. He went out to the shed. 4. He stood by the padlocked plank door for a moment, looking out along the path which led to the dig. Dusk had advanced far enough now so that the woods beyond the garden were a massy blue-gray with no detail to them. He saw no bobbing line of returning flashlights. But they could turn up. At any time at all, they could turn up and catch you with your arm all the way down in the jam jar. I think they'll spend a pretty good while out there mooning over it. They've got the Klieg lights. But you don't know for sure. No, not for sure. Gardner shifted his gaze back to the plank door. Between the planks, he could see that green light, and he could hear a dim, unpleasant noise, like an old-fashioned washing machine, with a gut full of clothes and thick suds. No, not just one washing machine, more like a whole line of them, not quite in sync. That light was pulsing in time to the low, slurping sound. I don't want to go in there. There was a smell. Even that, Gardner thought, was slightly sudsy, bland, with a faint hint of rancidity. Old soap, cakey soap. But it's no bunch of washing machines. That sounds alive. It's not telepathic typewriters inside there, not new and improved water heaters. It's something alive. And I don't want to go in there. But he was going to. After all, hadn't he come back from the dead just to look inside Bobby's shed and catch the Tommyknockers at their strange little benches? He supposed he had. Guard went around to the far side of the shed. There, hanging on a rusty nail under the eave, was the key. He reached up with a hand that trembled and took it down. He tried to swallow. At first he couldn't. His throat felt as if it had been coated with dry, heated flannel. A drink. Just one drink. I'll go into the house long enough to get just one, a short peg. Then I'll be ready. Fine. Sounded great. Except he wasn't going to do it, and he knew he wasn't. The drinking part was done. So was the delaying part. Holding the key tightly in his damp hand, Gardner went around to the door. He thought, don't want to go in. Don't even know if I can, because I am so afraid. Stop it. Let that part be over, too. Your Tommyknocker phase. He looked around again, almost hoping to see the line of flashlights coming out of the woods, or to hear their voices. But you wouldn't, because they talk in their heads. No flashlights, no movements, no crickets, no birdsong. The only sound was the sound of washing machines, the sound of amplified, leaky heartbeats. Slish, slish, slish. Gardner looked at the pulsing green light fingering its way through the cracks between the boards. He reached into his pocket, took out the old sunglasses, and put them on. It had been a long time since he had prayed, but he prayed now. It was short, but a prayer for all that. God, please, Jim Gardner said into the dim summer dusk, and slid the key into the padlock. 5. He expected a blast of head radio, but none came. Until it didn't, he hadn't realized that his stomach was tight and sucked in, like a man expecting an electric shock. He licked his lips and turned the key. A small noise, barely audible over the low slouching noises from the shed. Click. The hasp sprang up a little from the body of the lock. He reached for it with an arm that felt like lead. He pulled it free, clicked the hasp down, and put it into his left front pocket with the key still sticking out. He felt like a man in a dream. It was not a good one to be having. The air in there had to be okay. Well, perhaps not okay. Perhaps none of the air in Haven was exactly okay anymore. But it was about the same as the air outside, Gard thought, because the shed was a sieve of cracks. If there was such a thing as a pure Tommyknocker biosphere, this couldn't be it. At least he didn't think so. All the same, he would take as few risks as possible. He took a deep breath, held it, and told himself to count his steps. 3. You go in no more than 3 steps, just in case. 1 good look around, and then out, in 1 big hurry. You hope? Yes, I hope. He took a final look along the path, saw nothing, turned back to the shed,